Thank you, Nala. Honorable members, our support team from Parliament, our guests will be doing oral presentation to us, members of the media, and all those that are watching our portfolio committee today. Good morning. We're meeting today as the portfolio committee after a process which saw us visiting all the provinces seeking public views and comments on the Expropriation Bill 23 of 2020, which was the second phase or the process of how we're dealing with this bill after budget submissions. As we all know, what the bill presents, we received the request, which we dealt with for 2 days, hearing oral presentations, and today is the last day that we'll be dealing with oral presentations. So all those that are here today who are going to present their views in support of the bill or in objection of the bill, you are all welcome. Feel free to express your views, but we appeal to you in expressing your views. Don't insult those that are not with the view that you want or you feel that it is correct. And even don't insult us as the parliamentarians who are presenting the view to you, the bill to you, and who will process the bill after we have met with you. So you are all welcome, our guests, and we will listen attentively to what you will be presenting to us, knowing fully well that you have read the bill from its first page up to the last page, and we'll welcome all your views. But as you all know, that the final report will come from us as the portfolio committee, having looked at the written submissions that we received, at the views that we had from the 9 provinces that we visited, including the views that we will be hearing from you today. With those few words, you are all welcome. Ms. Martinite, can you outline the process that who is going to start and how many minutes are they all given? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to yourself, honorable members, our colleagues and our guests. First, Chair, I would like to start with the apology of Honorable Hicklin. She will not be able to attend today's meeting. The process is going to go as follows. Each presenter will be given 15 minutes to present their submission. And the schedule is as flighted on the screen. We'll start with Ms. Zanande Boy, who will be representing the Land and Accountability Research Center from the University of Cape Town. And thereafter, we'll follow with Professor Thuli Madonsela from the University of Stellenbosch. After that, we'll be followed by Mr. Yako Swart from the National Employers Association of South Africa, NIASA. After that, we'll follow the Natural Justice Lawyers for Communities and Environment. At about 10:15, we'll have Ms. Danele Luana, who's the Deputy President of the Black First Land First Movement. Thereafter, we'll have Mr. Brett Heron, who will be presenting on behalf of the Good Party, followed by Professor Sasa Pochenpo from the NRF. Around 11 o'clock, we'll have Ms. Lerato Poe, who will be presenting on behalf of the South African Institute of Valuers, followed by Ms. Anne Bernstein from the Center for Development and Enterprise. After that, will be Mr. Louis Vessel from Agri Western Cape, followed by Mr. Jan Bosman from Afrikaner Bond, Mr. Ivan Meyer, MEC of Agriculture, Western Cape Provincial Government, Ms. Veronica Mende from the Economic Freedom Fighters, And lastly, Mr. Forosadek, Ms. Musin Nxumalo, Mr. Tim Dunn, and Mr. Senzeni Mphila, who will be presenting on behalf of the ANC from the Gebi Shapiro branch in the Western Cape. Honorable Chair, after that, then will be the closing remarks from the chairperson, and then we will adjourn. I would like to highlight that if it happens that there's a speaker who is not available, we'll then have to move the following speaker forward. So that's why I have advised all the participants as I was liaising with them that they should all log in at the beginning of the meeting so that we can just move the process swiftly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez, for such a detailed program that we are going to follow. As you all have seen, you only have 15 minutes. You may use the full 15 minutes, or it may even be less, because you have prepared and you know where you want to zoom to. But please also note this. As the members of the portfolio committee, the only questions that may be asked are for clarities, not to discuss what will be presented by our guests. We will do our discussions when we are sitting as the portfolio committee, looking at all the views that we have had, the submissions, the presentations, and the report from the public hearings. So if anything that is going to be asked by any member of the portfolio committee is only questions of clarity. We will then start with Ms. Boy. Ms. Boy, you are welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I would like to start off by thanking you for inviting me to address you today. I'm Zinanda Boy. I'm the lead land researcher at the Land and Accountability Research Center at UCT. One of LARC's areas of focus relate to the impact of laws, policies, and practices of the state, as well as the conduct of private parties on the rights protected in Section 25(6) of the Constitution to secure tenure for rights to property that were previously unrecognized and unprotected as a result of racist laws in the past, as well as practices and policies. I went into some detail in the written submission about the various aspects. Today I want to only focus on a couple of those things, but I'm happy to answer any questions of clarity that were in the written submission, even if I don't deal with it here today in my oral submission. The first points I want to deal with relate to the bill's processes. In their current form, they do not adequately articulate the extent of proactive power to expropriate for a public purpose and in the public interest that the Constitution gives to and envisions for the state. The lack of power that the expropriating authority has to drive and conclude the expropriation process means that the process could be unduly delayed and invalidated at a very early point and at various points during the process. My other points relate to the bill's recognition and treatment of unregistered rights to property and land. This regulation and recognition of this right is incredibly important. However, the bill does not make provision for the tensions and imbalances of power in the status and legibility that exists between registered rights owners and those that hold unregistered rights to land. On the powers of the expropriating authority, the state's power to expropriate is already limited in the Constitution. It is limited internally but in Section 25(1). It is also limited by Section 33, Section 36, and 34 of the Constitution. So the Constitutional Court has already stated that legislation that attempts to articulate the powers of the state to give effect to constitutional rights, these laws need to be positive, purposive, and very generous to ensure that people are able to experience the full range of these rights and also the full range of protections that are given by these rights. However, instead of fully articulating the power of the state within the bounds of the Constitution, the bill as it currently stands places restrictions and hurdles in the way of the exercise of the state's expropriation powers. It contains cumbersome and procedural restrictions and hurdles that are not required by the Constitution and that were not present in the previous Expropriation Act of 1975. For example, the bill in setting up the process of investigation and valuation that happens when the state considers whether or not the property in question is appropriate for the process that it's intended to be expropriated for. The expropriation authority is required by the bill to obtain the consent of the owner at numerous points before any investigative activity can be undertaken by the person authorized by the state. These are the activities that the state needs to do to determine if this property is even suitable for the process or for the point for which it needs to be expropriated. And an impasse or an uncooperative owner can only be dealt with by going to court. So at the very early stage, the expropriation process could be easily tied up in litigation for years on the point that the owner refuses to give consent for any activities that are even intended at looking at whether or not the land or the property is appropriate for the intention that the state has for it. There is no such requirement in the 1975 Expropriation Act. There, the minister has extensive powers to ensure that the activities necessary to determine whether the suitability for the land, whether or not the land is suitable for the expropriation it's intended for, or in that context that the minister has to do is to give a person authority to enter that land, and the minister only needs to the person authorized by the minister only needs to give the owner of that land sufficient notice when activities are going to happen, and the owner is able to claim for any damages that may occur in the exercise of the activities intended for the investigation process. So it is our submission that all provisions in the Act, in the bill as it currently stands, that require the expropriating authority to obtain the consent of the owner before being able to access the property in question or conduct any investigative activities necessary to ascertain the suitability of the property for expropriation, should be revised to reflect the process in the current 1975 Act that appropriately empower the minister. And such an approach also properly protects the rights of the owner and properly respects the rights of anyone who holds rights into that land, and ensures that any expropriation process undertaken is effective and it is streamlined. The procedures set out in the expropriation bill need to be shortened and simplified, with the clear point at which negotiations must end and the court must be approached to determine what is just and equitable compensation. Currently, in that context, there are many parallel and overlapping processes that need to be removed to make sure that the process is fair and streamlined. We propose that the procedures be distilled in four succinct stages, either the first stage being a comprehensive investigation stage, the second then being followed by the notice of intention to expropriate, and then a mediation and a determination of just and equitable compensation stage, and then finally the notice of expropriation. The comprehensive investigation stage must not be stalled by consent-seeking processes or be solely dependent on the cooperation of the owner or rights holder for it to be able to proceed. This is also the stage at which the submissions and objections to the possible expropriation must be made and considered, not when the notice of intention to expropriate is issued, as is currently the case. This will ensure that an expropriating authority, when they're determining whether or not this property is suitable for expropriation, is able to take all the factors into account that are relevant for that decision, including any objections and any submissions on this consideration of expropriation. And then the notice of intention to expropriate must also include an initial determination by the expropriating authority of what it considers to be just and equitable compensation. As the bill stands, the initial claim must be made by the owner or the rights holder to which the expropriating authority must then respond. The equitable balance required in Section 25(3) between the interests of the public as well as the interests of those affected must be determined by the expropriating authority and not the owner or rights holder, by themselves being the ones who set the point of departure in the determination of just and equitable compensation. The person best placed to do that and to make those balances and to determine what is a good point of departure needs to be the expropriating authority after a comprehensive and thorough investigation process. These processes and hurdles currently in place in the bill will unduly limit the powers and the ability of the expropriating authority to act fairly and to act in a way that protects everyone's rights. I'm going to now deal briefly with the expropriation bill's recognition and inclusion of unregistered rights. So this is an incredibly important point forward, and regulating and recognizing these rights need to be expropriated properly and that they need to be treated as property rights is incredibly important. However, many of the procedures in the bill do not respond to the realities of continued subjugation faced by these rights holders, despite constitutional and legislative recognition and protection. The bill's procedures also fail to address the manner in which current practices are inadequately equipped to identify the nature, content, and the value of these unregistered rights. For example, a problem that has plagued land reform is the failure for the state to acknowledge the rights of those already living on land that is targeted for redistribution and restitution. Time and time again, the land that is awarded to redistribution and restitution beneficiaries is already occupied by people who hold unregistered rights. These can include labor tenants and farm workers on land that is acquired from white farmers, or people with long-standing appealable rights and customary law rights on land that is formerly owned by the South African Development Trust. One of the aims of this act is to improve the pace and delivery of constitutionally mandated land reform, but this can't happen in a way that simultaneously dispossesses people whose tenure is insecure of past racist laws, policies and practices. These rights need to be identified at the start of the process during the investigation stage, because the expropriation authority needs to know about the existence of these rights and the nature of these rights and the content of these rights before making a decision about whether or not it is suitable for this land to be expropriated. If there are people already on this land that are using it productively, then it may mitigate against awarding it to others for the purposes of restitution or redistribution. Another aspect of the bill that could put people's rights in jeopardy is that the bill places the onus largely on the owner of the property to identify and give the relevant information about unregistered rights holders to the expropriating authority. When ascertaining the existence of unregistered rights, the bill seems to require no more than that the owner provide names and addresses of all unregistered rights holders. There's no mention about how the nature and content of those rights is to be ascertained, or how they will be impacted by any expropriation process. The skewed power dynamics and tensions that exist between some of these unregistered rights holders and the registered rights holders, and that the state has not been able to protect them against the interests of registered rights holders, could mean that people who are unregistered rights holders will not be identified and not be properly treated as property rights owners, holders over this land. An example of this is really illustrated in sort of the relationship that exists between farm workers and farm owners, or farm owners and labor tenants. There are ample reports that have looked into and documented the significant challenges faced by farm workers and labor tenants, despite the constitution and legislation providing them with protection. There is widespread disregard for these rights, for the rights held by farm workers and labor tenants by farm owners, and there has been a lack of political will to implement the laws that are supposed to protect them. This has been documented by the Human Rights Commission, as well as the high-level panel report of the former President Mutlande. Farm owners, or people in charge of farms, cannot be solely relied on to ensure that holders of unregistered rights are appropriately identified. The reality is that farm workers and labor tenants are too vulnerable to be expected to themselves unilaterally assert their rights against farm owners who have systematically ignored the existence of those rights. Holders of rights and property in terms of customary law and the Interim Protection of Informal Land Rights Act also face significant challenges in ensuring that their rights are protected and recognized. Protections in appeal are subject to the Expropriation Act, so it is crucial that the Expropriation Bill makes proper and appropriate provision to ensure that the Constitution is not violated when these rights are expropriated. In order to begin to address existing shortcomings, we recommend that a comprehensive rights inquiry of all the occupants of the land that is targeted for expropriation by the Expropriation Authority be mandated at the investigation stage at the beginning. Given the widespread failure of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform to uphold and protect unregistered rights, the Expropriation Authority should be required to appoint a person with the necessary skills and expertise to identify and record each person that holds an unregistered right over a property. That person must be tasked with identifying the nature and content of these rights, as well as the applicable law, whether it is the Interim Protection of Informal Land Rights Act, ESTA, or the Labor Tenants Act, or any other tenure system that's recognized by the Constitution. My final point is that the formal cadastral system and mechanism of property valuations are not entirely suitable for determining the true value of these unregistered rights. The expropriation bill as it stands does not seem to recognize and make provision for this. Many unforeseen factors must be taken into account to determine the just and equitable compensation for these unregistered rights, and in many cases the market value is incredibly insufficient to properly compensate people for what they actually use. The expropriating authority must appoint someone who is qualified to properly determine the appropriate compensation for the unique context of unregistered rights holders at the investigative stage before any decision to expropriate is made. There cannot be a blanket burden placed on unregistered rights holders to ensure that their rights are protected. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions on what I've just presented.
Thank you, Ms. Boye, for such a detailed presentation, which shed some light in some of the things that many, I think the honourable members may agree with me on this one. Honourable members, any questions on Ms. Boye's presentation? Questions for clarity? I don't see any hand. Oh, Honorable Siwisa. Honorable Siwisa, over to you.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everyone. Ms. Boy, taking into consideration, I was listening to your presentation and also going through your notes. And with all the shortcomings that you've highlighted that are in the expropriation bill. In your view, what do you think, what should happen to the land?
Recording stopped.
What should happen to the land at this present moment?
Recording in progress.
Taking into consideration all the loopholes that you've highlighted, you spoke about imbalances of powers between registered and unregistered, blacks and whites, and then the restrictions and the hurdles within the bill when it comes to power of the state when it comes to the land issue. So with all the hurdles that you've highlighted, what should happen to the land at this present moment? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question. So I think just looking at how the bill is structured right now, I think the easiest and sort of the most sort of straightforward way to really respond to some of the things that I've highlighted is really taking away a lot of the duplicated processes that currently exist in the process that the expropriating authority is expected to go through. So I think right now the expropriating authority isn't properly empowered to actually do its job, because at various points the expropriating authority needs to get consent from the owner or get consent from the from a rights holder, and really what needs to be done to ensure that they is a clear process, that the way that the process begins needs to be clear and very streamlined, where the investigation is able to identify, I mean, even so the process, I mean, the issues I identified in the submission as well are really more general issues, but then the having a comprehensive investigation process or investigation stage where the expropriating authority has enough power to actually carry out that function, you're able to then identify more and respond to more. So I think right now what we need to be doing is properly empowering the expropriating authority to do exactly what it is that we want to do, which is ensure that we're able to have a clear, streamlined and accountable process of expropriation as is required by the Constitution. So, I mean, I think the point of departure is really doing away with many of the duplicated processes that exist and just having a very strong initial investigation stage where the expropriating authority has enough power to actually do its job, to understand the context that it's operating in, to ensure that the various rights that exist in those contexts are appropriately given effect to, appropriately protected, and no one is left without any recourse, and no one is left without with their rights not being properly given the due respect they need, be it farm owners, be it labor tenants, and be it farm workers or holders of customary law rights. I think they're moving from a point of departure of understanding that we need to be protecting all those rights. And in some stages and in some instances, particularly for unregistered rights holders, we need more protections to make sure that they have the same protections as registered rights holders, is what's really lacking in this bill, is that there's almost this assumption that everyone's on the same page and everyone's on the same level and everyone enjoys the same level of protection, when that's not the case, and there needs to be points at which very clear and overt protections are given to rights that are particularly vulnerable, which is, in this case, unregistered rights to land. Thanks. I hope I answered your question.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Boye, and even to the to to the question asked by Honorable Suwisa. Just a reminder, Honorable Members, it's question for clarity. We're still going to discuss and go deep in all the presentations that have been made as the Portfolio Committee, but we really appreciate your presentation. It is shedding some light in some of the things that are in the bill. Thank you so much, Ms. Boye. Yeah, I'm now going to invite Professor Tuli Madonsela from the University of Stellenbosch.
Good morning, sorry. Prof is just having some technical problems. She's trying to log on and Wi-Fi is giving her problems. Please, can we move on to the next speaker if they are there and if possible? She's really struggling right now.
Okay, thank you. We will then check the readiness of the following speaker. We again appeal to all the speakers to be ready, so that if at any time we have to skip a certain speaker due to challenges of network, or maybe the speaker is not yet in the meeting, So we really appeal that all the speakers should be ready. As we can see that Mr. Jacosart is ready, was the one who was going to follow Prof. Tuli Madonsela. Mr. Jacosart is from the National Employers Association of South Africa, NISA, and will be presenting their views. Mr. Sart, you are welcome. The floor is yours. You have 15 minutes to present to us. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the members of the committee for allowing me the opportunity to present on behalf of NASA. Upon the advent of the democratic era and the adoption of the African Constitution of 1996, our country was set upon a new path, a promise that never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. The business community has always seen the Constitution of the Republic of as a guarantee, not only for fundamental rights, but as a required framework to enable the private sector to create economic growth, jobs and wealth for all citizens. Today, despite the pure intentions of the Constitution and the fundamental rights contained therein, it is becoming evident that the epitome of legislation is being used as a vehicle to promote and implement ideals that will derail the economy and society. The clearest example of this is a sustained attack on property rights. Despite the apparent sanctity of the Constitution and the rights enshrined therein, together with the progressive aim of a fair land reform and or restitution, Parliament in February 2018 adopted the resolution that the need exists for government to have the ability and power to expropriate private property without the requirement of compensation. After this resolution and the public commentary process, the Constitutional Review Committee tabled its report to Parliament during November 2018. Now, NASA opposes the implementation of the EWC Bill for various reasons, one of which is the effect that the bill will have on business, in both their capacity as consumers and employers of this country. NASA strongly believes that fair and successful land reform requires a balance between existing land rights, food security and prosperous business on the one hand, and historical redress and restitution on the other. NIASA does not support any policies which undermine the ability of business to function optimally in this economic environment of South Africa. We believe that expropriation of property of any private business owner or any citizen through the EWC bill, the transfer of ownership of shares or stocks, will be devastating to not only those business owners, but in effect the employees, investors, and the economy in its whole. The EWC bill threatens the core belief of business owners in their ability to thrive in a free market dispensation in South Africa. Without this belief, the motivation of entrepreneurs to start and run their own business will simply vanish. The EWC bill destroys any safety measures the private sector has against an attack on property rights by government. Government's aim with the EWC bill to share the wealth will not be accomplished by EWC. EWC is a method of socialist redistribution which has globally failed spectacularly. Expropriation without compensation has failed in every jurisdiction where it was introduced. It has failed in Burundi, Ghana, Zimbabwe, India, Kenya, Nigeria, and Venezuela, to name but a few. There's nothing intrinsically unique about South Africa's position with regards to the implementation of its laws on EWC. It will inevitably fail, as it has failed in all other countries who chose this path. South Africa will be no exception. To believe the contrary would be foolish and an irrational denial of the existing irrefutable proof from other jurisdictions. I have dealt briefly in our submission with the different jurisdictions where it has been implemented, but for the sake of time, I will not go into that. I assume it has been read. One of the biggest and most threatening consequences of losing land or homes and farms, as well as businesses, is still bearing the responsibility to pay bonds on their already expropriated property. When borne in mind that the EWC bill not only affects farms of literal land, but also private property, homes, etc., a marked decrease in the value of property is an inevitable consequence of either an amendment to legislation or the consequent market uncertainty. The resulting reduced appetite from property buyers could further destabilize the banking sector and have a disastrous effect on both the property sector and the country's credit ranking. Broadly speaking, a property right is secure when the right holder perceives it to be stable, predictable, and protected from expropriation or arbitrary change. Security typically implies the ability to appropriate benefits arising from a particular property right. The economic case for secure property rights is that growth depends on investment. However, investors do not invest if there is a risk of expropriation. Any investor or business person will ask the following question. Would I invest in a country with uncertain property rights or repressed economic freedom? Will my money be safe? Will my investment grow? Would I invest in a country where economic freedom has deteriorated and the perception of property rights has regressed drastically? The answer will be a resounding no. The EWC bill, currently before Parliament, has the potential of devastating the South African economy. It holds the risk of setting in motion hyperinflation, the cessation of production, and severe shortages in foods, goods, and services. To understand this contention, we can examine the examples of Zimbabwe and Venezuela, where the core intention of the EWC bill, confiscation of property, was implemented. In Zimbabwe, Mugabe's land grabs accomplished the destruction of farmers' property rights and caused business confidence to plummet, resulting in hyperinflation, which at one point reached 80%. The majority of Zimbabweans were left destitute, as prices of goods and services multiplied throughout the course of a single day. In Venezuela, the country's constitution was amended and legislation to allow expropriation of large idle estates was introduced. Although the expropriation process in Venezuela was started on a limited scale initially, with the aforementioned constitutional amendments only targeting large and idle estates, it was shortly thereafter expanded to agricultural properties and went on to expand further to all types of enterprises and their assets. This resulted in a 40% decrease in the production of staple crops. These shortages were initially covered by using Venezuela's oil wealth to import food, but when the oil price plummeted in 2014, rationing of food and price controls became necessary and unavoidable. The eventual result being food riots, hijacking of food trucks, and the violent looting of stores. By 2018, Venezuela's annual inflation rate had reached 65,000%. If South Africa follows Zimbabwe and Venezuela in allowing confiscation of property, the economic implications will be the same. Similar hyperinflation, shortages, and upheaval can be expected. South Africa is a country in dire need of increased, stimulated economic activity and capital investment. Creating hysteria and mass uncertainty regarding rights in the Constitution, in this case property rights, is the worst road to take. If EWC were to be accepted and adopted, even in diluted form, it would be the straw that breaks the fragile economy camel's back. South Africa has been cut down at the knees due to COVID-19, transformation rules that closed the funding tap for private entities who do not adhere to BEE compliance requirements, and now the government is threatening the core of business owners and their financial institutions' survival. Banks and other financial institutions are, in the majority of cases, the method by which some Africans finance properties such as homes, agricultural land, vehicles, factories, businesses, and many other assets. The private sector has been the lifeblood of the South African economy for most of its democratic existence. EWC will inspect every single business, whether big or small, or demolish what remains of a post-COVID economy, drive away any possible investors, local and international, break down what is left of the trusting government, and flare up social tensions in South Africa. NIASA recommends that any portion of this bill which provides for the expropriation of property with no compensation should be removed from the bill. That is, the entirety of the preamble and the purpose of the bill must be revised. Section 12.1 to 12.4 must be revised or deleted, or alternatively, the entire bill should be reconsidered. The broader definition of property and which property may be expropriated, as well as for which purpose, needs to be clarified and well defined. If there is any real desire from government to efficiently implement land reform measures, expropriation must be done with compensation, at least for the security and respect of property rights. This will require an entirely different approach to the one proposed in the bill. The bill sets a political goal, land redistribution above the economic interests of South Africa's citizens. NIASA supports land restitution, that is, compensating those who were historically or are currently deprived of their assets by the state. Where government has stolen property from an individual or community, historically or currently, compensation must be made. The expropriation bill creates a framework that exposes every South African, employer and employee, to the risk that their property can be taken without their consent. History has shown that property rights prevent the mechanism through which individual rights are given impetus. Societies collapse in situations where the state has absolute authority as in the manner provided for in the expropriation bill. Zimbabwe and Venezuela, as mentioned earlier, are but recent examples. But Africa is on the verge of repeating the horrific mistakes of these countries. In these dispensations where property rights are disregarded, but even the Constitution has little value. The answer submit that this legislation is ill-conceived and should be withdrawn. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jaco. We note all your concerns and your views. As I indicated earlier, we will discuss this as the portfolio committee, and of course we will be assisted by our legal arm in the parliament. Any questions for clarity, honorable members? For clarity, please, not for discussions. We'll do that when we are on our own. Any questions for clarity, honorable members? In the absence of a hand, let me again appreciate your thorough investigation. It's clear that you made your research before coming here, Mr. Sartre. We appreciate that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chairperson.
The following speaker, there is no name here, Ms. Martinez.
Chair, I think we can move back to Prof. Madonsela. I believe she's online now.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Prof, we had to reschedule you because you were not online. We heard that you have challenges of connectivity. We welcome you in the meeting. And now the floor is yours. Professor Madonsela.
Thank you, Honorable Chair Ntobongwana, and to Honorable Members. It is a major privilege for me on behalf of the Social Justice Chair to engage with you today on the expropriation bill. I just want to know, Honourable Chair, if I'm allowed to share the document I have.
Yes, Prof, you can do that. Ms. Nola, please give the sharing right, but you only have 15 minutes to do that.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. Right, Honourable Chairperson, as I was indicating, it is a privilege to address you. I had to change a laptop and this one is very slow. My other laptop just packed up. So I apologize to you.
Can we ask, Prof, if our team has your presentation, ask them to flight it for you, then you talk to it. Oh, you are fine now.
Finally, ma'am. I do apologize. I know I now have probably 12 minutes. I'll try to rush through it. I'm presenting on behalf of the Law Trust Chair in Social Justice at Stellenbosch University. It is an honor and privilege to address the Portfolio Committee on the Expropriation Bill. And as a Law Trust Chair in Social Justice, we welcome the initiative. And we do so on the belief that it is just and proper that a new Expropriation Act that is attuned to our Constitution replaces the current Expropriation Act number 63 of 1975. And in this regard, we think there's been a misunderstanding in the public debate. People did not seem to realize that there is expropriation that is going on in this country, and it has gone on forever. And in all countries, there is expropriation. So the bill does not introduce expropriation. What it does, it redefines the parameters for expropriation. Having accepted that we must change the 1975 Expropriation Act, which according to Daniel versus Brabante, that Expropriation Act was introduced for nefarious reasons. It was part of an extractive system of laws and policies that were aimed at undermining black prosperity, oppressing black people and making it impossible for them to prosper through having any form of secure property, be it land in the urban areas or land in the rural areas, and also immovable property that is on land. We offer commentary though on the aspect that could undermine social justice, democratic governance and equal enjoyment of land and related property rights for disadvantaged groups in breach of the constitutional commitment to social justice. As the Law Trust Chair in Social Justice at Stellenbosch University, we welcome the prospect that the Expropriation Bill could usher in the constitutionalism that expands the frontiers of freedom and social justice for ordinary people such as the Peter sisters, whose name I have changed, and the Dlamini family, whose name I've also changed, who were affected by predatory and corrupt abuse of power in the exercise of expropriation and related regulatory authority over land by relevant authorities. But we also think that this bill has the potential of contributing to an accelerated pace for land reform, land restitution, and sustainable development. We do understand that this act is not about land reform and it's not about land restitution. It is an expropriation act and it is updating an existing regime, but it has potential for this. Just quickly to say, Miss Peters are people whose parents bought land in the Eastern Cape, and you can imagine how difficult it was to buy land. And then in New South Africa, we have a new constitution that promises them an improved quality of life, and it promises them that we're establishing a society that is founded on democratic values, which includes participation, recognition, on social justice, which includes, again, fairness and reparation, and fundamental human rights, which includes embracing all rights and freedoms for all persons. Their property was taken up by a municipality to allow a mall to be built there. They were not consulted before this was done, and whilst the process had already started, they tried to stop it to no avail, and then they wanted then compensation, they didn't get it. And what was their problem? They have no property. They have no money other than the fact that they inherited this property. This is the only asset in their hands. To be able to defend their rights now, they need money. But if somebody had just done the right thing, they wouldn't have had to need money. And if they don't get the money, they will not be able to defend their rights. And this property that has been annexed by the municipality or the authority that this is. They think it's the municipality, but it may well be somebody else within the government sphere. So they might lose this property forever, or the piece of their property that has been annexed. They've approached the Tuma Foundation, they've approached us as social justice chair, but we don't really deal with difficult cases. So I'm bringing it to your attention, honourable members, to give you an example of what we hope this bill has. It has a chance for a constitutionally attuned land reform, restitution, and rights protection. The Dlamini family were somewhere in KZN, and I'm not going to mention the community, but they were farming umoba or sugar cane, and when, just before they harvested, the father of the family died. And when they wanted to harvest, the traditional authority told them that he now owns the field. They would have to pay anew to lease this property. And in the absence of that, he has other development priorities for it. There are many others. I mean, during my time as Park Protector, people approached me about a piece of their land that has been annexed for mineral rights or for right-of-way for some or other road without their consultation and without their compensation. So it does seem to me that if this bill goes through with the necessary amendments, it can really define better parameters that are in line with the Constitution when it comes to when do we take away people's land with or without compensation, and when do we expropriate the land and how we expropriate. And we also think that it could fast track the process of restitution and sustainable development. So about the chair, we are a chair in social justice that started operating in January 2018 at Stellenbosch University with a view to deepening and expanding social justice research and scholarship to ensure that we make an impact in society, particularly in regards to social impact conscious law and policy making. So you are our natural clients. That's why we feel extremely privileged to engage with you, and we hope we can engage with you again in future circumstances when we're not discussing a bill, but we just discussing the theory of change behind the tools that we created, one of them being called a social impact, a social justice impact assessment matrix. For us, social justice refers to the equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms by all, reflected in just, equitable, and fair distribution of all opportunities, resources, benefits, privileges, and burdens in a society, group, and between societies. So with this social justice as envisaged in the Constitution, no group should find it easier or more onerous to exist in a society or to enjoy the benefits of living in a democracy. This definition comes from the Copenhagen Declaration. It's, in other words, we have some of its DNA comes from the Copenhagen Declaration of 1995, from other UN documents, but particularly influenced by our own case law. Key among those laws is S versus Makwanyane, which links social justice to Ubuntu, and Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden, which says social justice must include restitution. And therefore, if we're going to discuss land rights, a fast-tracking restitution is extremely important, and that, of course, means redefining rights between citizens. And social justice, according to John Rawls, is just about fairness to all. And we cite some of the case law, S versus Makwanyane. I think just key there is that it was the understanding of Justice Madala that the provision of social justice and the African value of Ubuntu in the interim constitution was to introduce a transformative ethos. And he then says, the constitution in its preamble declares there is a need for understanding, not vengeance, for reparation, but not retaliation, a need for Ubuntu, but not victimization. So the concept of Ubuntu appears for the first time in the preamble, but it is a concept that permeates the constitution generally, and more particularly Chapter 3, which embodies the entrenched fundamental human rights. The concept carries with it the ideas of humaneness, social justice, and fairness. Why I'm reading this is that in the new constitution, social justice is only mentioned in the preamble. But we can read from Justice Madala that the current, then, Chapter 2 of the Constitution is founded on social justice because it's about fairness to all. And often people think that social justice is only about socioeconomic rights. They are wrong. Social justice is about equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms, and that's what Justice Musteneke tells us in Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden. In other words, everyone is entitled to land, for example. Not only those who have it now, not only those, for example, who can prove ownership of some land that was owned before. Because, as you know, Honourable Chairperson, the issue of land at the moment has been restricted to 1913. Yet land dispossession started in the 17th century. And Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden says specifically, absent positive commitment progressively to eradicate socially Chairperson, I'm struggling with something. Okay, I'm going to leave that paragraph in the interest of time. And just basically paraphrase what, according to Justice Musteneke in Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden, social justice is about fairness to all, but in our country where the default situation is that others were excluded from equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms, we are compelled by the Constitution to advance their equal enjoyment of those rights. And I do agree with Minister of Finance versus Van Heerden, because Section 7.2 enjoins you in government to protect these rights, to advance them, and to ensure that everyone enjoys them. Right. In that regard, I'm not going to go to clauses because my colleague, Professor Bokenpool is going to be talking to you on clause by clause. But as a social justice chair, our interest is just to make sure that whatever is going to be done, there is a clear understanding of how will this impact on different groups in society, because we believe, as Minister of Finance, Mrs. Van Heerden says, that Parliament and all state functionaries have the duty to ensure two things when passing a law, a policy or program. That number one, it does not exacerbate existing inequality and poverty. Number two, that it actually reduces existing inequality and poverty. And the UK Equality Act Section 149 makes that compulsory. They don't even have a constitution like ours where there's a promise of social justice and a clear equality duty in the constitution, but they will not pass a law until they have tested it for impact on the various groups in society. So, but we are saying, in terms of what this bill improves, there's greater human rights awareness, there's recognition of all groups, including those living under customary law. There's democratization of the process. So there is some kind of administrative law requirements, the process, that long process that has been elaborated in the bill. There's also, the bill offers an opportunity to test implicit constitutional permission of expropriation. I personally do think that Section 25 does enable the expropriation of land without compensation. We can discuss under what circumstances is that possible. And therefore, you could test this instead of changing the constitution. But what are our concerns? The bill is so technical. It's a long process and it's very expensive. It's going to be very expensive for Mrs. Peter and the Dlamini family. So their life is not going to be improved because of this bill. You need upfront capital to vindicate your rights under the law that is being proposed. So a Gogo Dlamini such as Mrs. Peter, the Peter family and the Dlamini family will not have that capital. What then happens? Right now, for example, we have, in terms of when widows inherit a home from their husband, they're required to conveyance that home and they don't have money. Many of them have lost their homes, and again, as Tuma will be approaching you about the injustice that's happening in that regard. The group rights don't seem to be clearly recognized, so we need to make sure, for example, the Peter family, they are a group, it's not one person, but under customary law in particular, there are those group rights of families, of communities. The fourth one, it could impact negatively on investment, not just foreign direct investment. We heard at one of the food security events that we organized here at Stellenbosch University that some people are reluctant to invest in agriculture in their own places and in property with their own money. The stock firms that have money to invest in property, they're reluctant to invest if there's no security. Food security is also threatened. So what do we recommend? We recommend a social impact assessment, an affordability impact assessment, not affordability for government, affordability for the ordinary person. And then lastly, to use the UK Equality Act approach where government understand you've got an equality duty, and therefore before you pass this law, will it make things better for everyone, but particularly Gogo Dlaminis? And lastly, will it increase equality and reduce poverty? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Prof. We added time to you because we had challenges flighting your presentation. I was about to stop. For clarity, honourable members. Any questions for clarities, honourable members? In the absence of questions for clarities, let's appreciate the time that you have spent with us, Professor, and your presentation, which is detailed. We will look at it and deal, as we will be dealing so, with other presentations when we are discussing this bill. The next speaker, thank you, Prof, again. for your time. Our next speaker, I don't know whether you finally got Nola or him, the speaker from the Natural Justice Lawyers for Communities and Environment.
Honorable Chair, we didn't get any confirmation nor a name of a presenter, so I would like to propose that we move to the next one if in the absence thereof.
Thank you. Ms. Zanelwe Luana, the Deputy President of Blackfest Landfest BLF. You are welcome, Bogodo. Over to you. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, honorable members of parliament. And as I have been just introduced, my name is Zanele Luana, and I am the Deputy President of the Black Consciousness Pan-Africanist organization in the country, Blackfest Landfest. And as everyone would know, the president of this organization is Comrade Andile Mota. So I have been asked by my organization to make an oral submission on behalf of Blackfest Landfest. And I think before I start, as the chair had requested, if I've seen correctly, it's for us to state our position. Do we accept the bill as it is, or do we reject it? And as Blackfest Landfest, as the bill has been formulated, we reject this bill. So I hope that is clear to everyone. And I think before I continue, I just want to cement this, that since 1994, the dawn of the so-called democratic dispensation in the country, the ruling party in charge of government all these years has been trying to buy stolen property as part of their plan for land redress or land redistribution. And from figures that are known by everyone, the governing party has only really been able to just buy back only 8% of the land, and the ruling party has spent billions of money, more than 50 billion rand just on this. So Blackfest Landfest rejects this bill, and we ask this committee to do the same. This committee must not attach its name to this bill. And we believe that this bill has been clearly crafted to deceive and mislead the people of South Africa, particularly the landless black majority. We say as Blackfest Landfest, as we have went into detail when we submitted our written submission, this bill has nothing to do with the expropriation of land without compensation. This bill has nothing to do with addressing the uneven property relations in the country, where the white minority owns 80% of the land. This is productive land, and this is land that out of some proceeds, the key sectors driven by land are central in driving the economy of this country. So we do not think this bill seeks to address this fundamental big difference, and this uneven ownership in terms of land. It is as a result of colonialism legislated into apartheid, and since 1994, all we have done as a country is to call for reconciliation, is to call for a rainbow nation. We have been calling for diversity in unity, but we do not want to do what is just, so that we may build a society where black people are not set back because of historical injustices that we have not been able to correct. So we have proposals as Blackfest Landfest, and as I have said before, we ask the committee to reject this bill. And we want, as a way forward, enact a land expropriation bill to give effect to the desire for land expropriation without compensation as a tool of redress. Such an act, we say, must be guided by the following principles. Number one, it must be clear in writing and in verbatim and in speech that all land in the hands of the white minority in the country is stolen property. Number two, we say the primary purpose then of redistribution of land to the black majority is for historical redress. We go on further and say all black people have rights to land in South Africa, and we have rights to this land without payment that should be demanded from us. We say one of these principles that should guide this act should be that all black people have the right to land in South Africa without payment. I've made that point already. Eviction of farm workers, poor people, from land in South Africa must be regarded as illegal. And we say as Black First Landers, land in the hands of black people, such as the Ingonyama Trust, must be exempted from land expropriation without compensation, because this is land already in the hands of black people. This is land already in the hands of the victimized. So when we say we want land expropriation without compensation, we want to give access to land to the landless, poor majority of the country that lives in abject poverty today. So therefore, part of historical redress cannot be now again targeting land such as the Ingonyama Trust in the hands of black people and saying this land will be our priority in our mission to redistribute land. We say as Black First Land First, a new department which shall be called the Department of Land Redistribution must be established, and its sole mandate shall be the redistribution of land to the landless in this country. And then we also say on the issue of determination of mortgage bonds must be adjusted to a value that excludes land as a determining factor in housing price, because land must be offered to the landless majority of this country for free. So that is what we are saying with this bill in its current form, that if it does not echo these principles that I have just went over now, we would have failed the landless black majority of this country. Perhaps we should ask critical questions in our understanding. Will this bill as it is respond to the needs of black people? And we say as Black First Land First that the expropriation bill, unfortunately, leaves the landless at the mercy of the courts. And I'm going to give reasons now on why we say that. We say it has failed, the bill as it is has failed, four important tests. Number one, the first question, does the bill end the willing buyer, willing seller policy and practice? The answer is no. Question number two, does the bill ensure that land will be in the hands of the landless black majority? The answer is no. Third question, does the bill as it is resolve the meaning and criteria of just and equitable compensation? We say the answer is no. And the last question, does the bill set targets as constitutional imperative for land redistribution? We say the answer is no. So we say as Black First Land First, this bill as it is just a piece of paper to avoid doing what is right. We see this bill as a retreat from the truth. And we say as Black First Land First, this bill as it is, it becomes another mechanism for parliamentarians, for politicians in this country to appear as if they are doing something. When in actual fact, the people who have been entrusted, at least by vote, by our people, are doing nothing in government as well as in parliament. So we say as Black First, Land First, this bill is in essence a bill of cowardice. And we ask that this committee to not be part of this process where we want to seem as if we are doing something about the landless permanent condition of our people, but in essence we know that if this bill goes to the next phase as it is, if it is accepted, you know, adopted, all the necessary the processes moving forward continue. We say this bill as it is in its DNA, it does not deal with the issue of resolving the landlessness of Black people in this country. I would like to repeat that as Black First, Land First, we are saying South Africa belongs to Black people, and the land question arises out of arrival of a white minority colonized the indigenous people in this country. That's how Black people are landless in this country. This is as a result of 1652, where a white minority dispossessed the indigenous people in this country. So because of this undisputable fact, we should all agree that all land in South Africa is stolen property then. And to this end, racism arises from this colonial land theft we have failed to address as Black people. So what we are saying as Black First, Land First, as I move towards summation, we are saying when it comes to Section 25 of the Constitution, this expropriation bill supports Section 25 as it is, without amendments, and this bill does this by virtue of securing the rights of whites who have not admitted that they stole the land of Black people, and nothing has been done to return this land. So this bill, as it is, secures the rights of the white minority in historically stolen property, and this compels us we are expected now as the Black landless majority to provide compensation to a group in this country that has not done anything to make sure that the crimes and the injustices are corrected, and so that Black people have access to land and we have dignity. So what we are saying as Black First, Land First, we are proposing, in fact, when it comes to the issue on the amendment of the Section 25 of the Constitution, we say remove the whole of question of Section 25 of the Constitution. And Section 25 must be replaced in the Constitution with the following. The first point of critical importance is that all land held by the white minority in the country is stolen property. It should follow and be explicit in saying that all Black people have the right to land in South Africa without any form of payment. We don't owe anyone. And we repeat that the eviction of farm workers and the poor from land that they find themselves in It's illegal, and that the constitution must make it illegal for the white minority to evict black people. We say, as black first land, first land occupation by the landless must be made lawful, because why are people occupying land in this country year in, year out? It shows that we have not dealt with the fundamental question of redress. And we are saying then, as black first land, first, let us not allow ourselves, we are saying to the nation, let us not allow ourselves to be fooled by politicians. This land we are talking about today was taken from black people by force, and as black people who are landless in this country, if we are not willing to fight for this land, and this bill stands the danger of being adopted as it is, and we say fundamentally the bill fails to respond to the needs of black people. I would like to find out if I have any minutes left before I continue, or should I just stop and allow the opportunity for some clarity seeking question. I'll pause here for now.
Yeah, Ms. Lana, you have I think it's only your the timer goes on. Just wanted to show you have few seconds left. Your time is up. Thank you for your presentation, which is detailed and clear. And also, we appreciate the fact that you indicated whether you support or you are in objection of the bill. We really want that from all the presenters that will be coming in. Any questions for clarities, honorable members? Any questions for clarity? I don't see any single hand. I don't see any single hand. Thank you again, Ms. Lana, for such a detailed presentation, which indicates and also shows the background of the issue of the land in our country. Thank you, Mbogoto. We now go to the next speaker. Ms. Martini said, did you finally get someone from Natural Justice Lawyers for Communities and Environment?
No, Chair. I propose we move to the Good Party. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The Good Party, Mr. Brett Heron. The Good Party, is Mr. Brethren in the platform?
I don't see Mr. Heron on the platform. I propose we move to the next speaker.
Okay, a reminder again that all the speakers should log in on the platform. So if we have to skip another speaker, then we'll definitely come to that speaker. We will now invite Prof. Bochen, is it Bochenpool? Yeah, Prof. Bochenpool.
Good morning. Prof. Bochenpool asked me to present on the behalf of the group of academics. I'm Professor Elminde Plessé.
Okay.
May I proceed, please?
Okay. But I want to just sensitize the following. The South African Institute of Values, the Center for Development and Enterprise, Agri Western Cape, Afrikaner Bond, Western Cape Provincial Government, EFF. Can they be ready? But if any of the following speakers are not in, we then jump to the one who is ready. Ms. Duplessis, over to you.
Right. Thank you very much, and good day to everybody. And thank you for inviting the chair, that's the chair, South Africa Chair in Property Law, to speak sorry, I've got the wrong speech here. But to speak here today, I do apologize. I also had difficulties with the internet, and I had to go over all over Joburg to find a working internet, but here we are. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to make an oral submission on the bill that we deem very important and necessary. So I want to start with that. We are a group of academics. We are loosely associated with the NRF South African Research Chair in Property Law under Prof. Zata Bochenpool. We are experts in the field of property law in general and also constitutional property law specifically. We welcome the bill and we think the bill in general is necessary. We have provided substantive written submission only because we are academics that find fault with things. So this oral submission will only highlight a few of the problems that we foresee that might be possible in the bill. So we focus on the definitions, we focus on clause 12.3, and we focus on clause 19 that deals with municipalities. So I try to keep the comments as brief as possible without oversimplifying the issues. So please do ask if I need to clarify anything specifically. So the definitions clause in legislation serves as a very important function, as they can limit the meaning or deviate from the ordinary meaning of a word and give it a technical meaning that will be applicable in that specific piece of legislation. So definitions will therefore be limited to the meaning ascribed to them in the specific piece of legislation unless the context otherwise dictates. Definitions also need to comply with the spirit, purpose, and the objects of the Bill of Rights. With this in mind, we raised concerns on some of the definitions. I'm just going to focus on the one, namely expropriation. So we have concern with the definition of expropriation as the compulsory acquisition of property by an expropriating authority or an organ of state upon request to an expropriating authority, and then with expropriate as the corresponding meaning. The requirement of compulsory acquisition is in line with existing law, case law specifically. The importance of having an interference with property rights classified as an expropriation is the following. It's not a requirement, but the consequence of a valid expropriation is ordinarily that the state must pay compensation. This compensation may be nil if it is just and equitable to do so, this bill clarifies, but the obligation to pay remains, and the state must still prove why nil rent is in fact just and equitable. The same, however, is not true for a deprivation. Therefore, the way we define the term expropriation will directly influence the measure of protection that property rights enjoy and the clarification of exactly when compensation is due. The focus on the acquisition element of expropriation is often problematic, also in other jurisdictions. Expropriation entails more than a mere acquisition, and in some instances there might be a possibility of an expropriation without actually acquiring anything. For instance, expropriation mostly requires a final taking away of property, whether it's temporary or permanent, while a mere deprivation limits the use and enjoyment of the property. Deprivation of property through regulation usually affects a category, a general category of property, while expropriation usually affects specific owners in specific circumstances only. Deprivation stems from the state's regulatory or police power, while the authority to expropriate, as you all well know, rests on the Constitution. And the intention behind the deprivation is usually not to acquire the property, but to regulate it for health and safety reasons, while with an expropriation, the intention is to acquire the property for a specific public purpose or in the public interest. Therefore, to reduce expropriation only to acquisition is problematic. A richer definition, in our opinion, would focus on the source of the power that the state uses, the purpose of the restriction, the effect of the interference, whether the property is acquired or not, and the permanence or the finality of the interference. That is to distinguish it specifically also from deprivation. These factors, we think, should be considered together without one being an absolute requirement. Another way of making meaning of expropriation clearer and more specific is to set as a statutory requirement that expropriation requires formal statutory authorization. That means it must be authorized in legislation, coupled with, of course, the exercise of an administrative discretion. This is also in line with the requirement in section 25(2) that requires that expropriation must be done in terms of a law of general application that will also then set out the public purpose or interest for the expropriation. So we have a preliminary suggestion for a definition that says, I think it's also in our written submission, that expropriation is, but it's not restricted to, the compulsory acquisition of property by an expropriating authority upon request to an expropriating authority and must be authorized by legislation that specifically provides for expropriation and that sets out the public purpose or public interest for that expropriation and that makes provision for the payment of just and equitable compensation. Okay. So the termination of compensation, I'm going to move over to clause 12.2, but 12.3 I think is the one that's most controversial, I would presume. So clause 12 will replace section 12 of the current act and lays down the principles that must be adhered to when determining compensation. So it makes it clear that the compensation standard remains just and equitable, which we agree with, and not market value, which we should move away from, thereby bringing it in line with the Constitution. It might help to distinguish between value and compensation. We go into more detail in our submission into that, where value will refer to the actual value of the property and compensation involves questions of justice and equity that allow for discretion in determining what is just and equitable. We note that clause 12.3 was inserted, presumably in the climate of the discussion of the Constitution's possible amendment, to indicate the instances where nil compensation can be paid. The wording makes it clear that it is not without compensation, but nil compensation, thereby the obligation to at least justify the calculation of nil compensation is retained, which we also view as correct. Arguably, the obligation to pay compensation, even if it is null rand, is an integral part of expropriation, and the absence of which would mean that it is no longer an expropriation. It should be noted that all of the examples listed in clause 12.3 refer to the use of land, and it is unclear for us why this needs to be stipulated then, seeing that the current use of property is a factor in terms of clause 12.1a that can be taken into account when determining just and equitable compensation. It is therefore not entirely clear, but nonetheless we comment on the various clauses. So the clause 12.3a, which changed from speculative purposes to requirement that the land must not be used and that the owner does not want or to develop or use the land to generate income, it clarifies what is meant with speculative purposes, but the concern is still raised where land is not used in the sense of being built on or developed or farmed, but rather for something like environmental purposes, whether this will still need to be justified as nil compensation. So I think there our question is who will determine when land is not used, what is acceptable or not acceptable use for land. 12.3b refers to land owned by state-owned enterprises. It should be noted that this is not really state land. State land need not be expropriated. The state does not expropriate its own land. But this should probably be read with clause 2.2, where the minister is authorized to only expropriate such property with the consent of the minister responsible for that entity. And we are just concerned that there might be some problems requiring consent from such a minister. And also because the very nature of expropriation is that an owner does not have to consent to the expropriation. And we are just wondering why such a minister will be treated differently from other owners. So we've seen instances of this that due to politicking, property may never be expropriated. Housing is a very good example here. It's a concurrent national and provincial competency, while the municipal planning is a municipal competency. So if a municipality wants to plan low-cost housing sections and wants to include the state-owned entity's land, there might be a possibility that the minister in charge will not agree with this. So we elaborate more on that in our written submission, but we think this is something that needs to be flagged. Section clause 12 3C looks at land that is abandoned by the owner. So a little bit of law nerding here. This needs to be clarified. In our opinion, in law, property is only considered abandoned when the owner gives up the intention to be an owner, usually with the loss of physical control, but mere physical control would not constitute abandonment. So it's even more difficult when we deal with immovable property in South Africa, because it's not really possible to abandon immovable property, because there are no mechanisms in the laws that give it proper effect to the principle of publicity in this regard. So in most cases where immovable property is abandoned, these properties, although physically abandoned by the owner, is still legally owned by the owner. So we are just concerned that in some instances owners leave their property because they can no longer effectively protect themselves and the properties from unlawful invasions, occupations at least. Will this also constitute abandonment? So there are a few issues, legal issues there, that we think need attention. For instance, should abandonment have the legal meaning in the sense that it's no, then it's actually also not necessary to expropriate the property as abandoned things in our law can be, it's another form of original acquisition. I don't want to go into too much legalese, namely occupatio. So in the absence of abandonment having the legal meaning as outlined, we subclause C would presumably be speaking about owners who are not using their property or have deserted it for some reason. And if that is the case, we're also not sure what's the difference between this subclause and subclause A. 12.3D speaks to where the value of the land is equivalent or less than the value of direct state investment. It's not clear if this clause is targeting farmers who historically benefited from state support or whether it also includes current beneficiaries of land reform projects. Most of these farms are still registered in the name of the state. Other than that, it is not clear how this differs from the factor of direct state investment in 12.1D. 12.4 deals with labor tenants. We are fine with that, but we are also just concerned why no provision is also made for this, only for this class of claimants and not, for instance, for restitution claims. I'm going to move on to Clause 19, which is also quite technical. It is confusing, Clause 19.1, as it creates the impression that paying the charges mentioned there in that clause is a prerequisite for transfer of ownership and consequent registration in the case of expropriation. So it is important to note that since expropriation is an original form of acquisition, transfer does not take place upon registration in the deeds office, so it's not required, but rather on the date stipulated in the expropriation notice. In this regard, registration in the expropriation context is not a requirement for the vesting of ownership as registration would ordinarily be in other instances. Okay, the wording and conceptual confusion in this regard just needs some clarification. It is further a little bit more confusing as property that's transferred upon registration in the deeds office, section 181 of the Municipal System Act, must also be complied with. This means that a rate clearance certificate must be obtained before registration takes place in the deeds office. This is not the case with an expropriation. The deeds office is compelled by law to record the expropriation. There's not an application for registration with a deeds transfer as during a normal process of transfer of ownership. Rather, the registration only fulfills the role of updating the record. So Clause 19 enables then the expropriating authority to pay over monies to settle rates, taxes, and other amounts owed to the municipality to obtain rates clearance certificates. And these monies are normally deducted from the compensation offered to the expropriated owner. This is, however, not mandatory. It also does not require that the rates clearance certificate must be obtained, and this can interfere with the municipality's ability to collect revenue or to comply with the constitutional duties. So we also explain this in detail, but we just want to say that Clause 19 should expressly provide that the clearance certificate is needed before expropriation can take place. It must be mandatory for the expropriating authority to use the expropriated owner's compensation money to obtain the right clearance certificate, at least where there is no disputes to the amounts owed. So these are rather technical. The rest of our submission is also quite technical, but we want to thank you for the opportunity to make a written and an oral submission on this law. We feel very passionate about this law, as you can see, and we deem it very important. We hope that the uncertainties or the clarifications that we seek in our submission will help to ensure that this is a more effective expropriation bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Du Plessis, on your presentation. We appeal to all the presenters, even those that are still coming, to forward their presentations to Ms. Martinez, so that when you're presenting, we are also reading on what you're presenting, so that we can take notes. Any questions for clarities, honorable members? Any questions for clarities? In the absence of any hands, we appreciate and thank you for the presentation, which is very detailed and has recommendations of what needs to be done. Thank you, Mr. Plessis. We then invite Mr. Brett from Good Party. I believe that he is in the platform now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Proceed. Hello, Chairperson.
May continue.
Oh, thank you.
Floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to all the members of the committee. Chairperson, so the purpose of an oral submission is really just to supplement what we have submitted in writing. The starting point that we support the repeal of the 1975 Expropriation Act and the replacement or the enactment of the 2020 Expropriation Bill. I'll just briefly remind the committee of what our submission was with regards to the 2020 Expropriation Bill. And the starting point is that the Constitution, Section 25 of the Constitution, provides for expropriation of property for the purposes of land reform and provides circumstances already in which compensation for that expropriation may be nil. That the 2020 Expropriation Bill therefore does not introduce expropriation at all into the law. It already exists. And it doesn't introduce expropriation without compensation into our law. It is already provided for in the Constitution. Chairperson, this bill does what Section 25(1) of the Constitution requires. It provides that a law of general application gives effect to the constitutionality of expropriation, including without compensation. And this interpretation of Section 25 of the Constitution has already been confirmed by the Constitutional Court in 2002 in the case First National Bank of South Africa versus the Minister of Finance, where the court said that there are appropriate circumstances where it is permissible for legislation in the broader public interest to deprive persons of property without payment of compensation. So much of the opposition to this bill, or comments on this bill, has been generated, as we just heard, in response to Clause 12(3), which deals with nil compensation. And as I indicated previously, the bill does not introduce nil compensation into the law. It is already provided for by the Constitution. It gives effect to that provision in the Constitution. Jefferson, the reason for making an oral submission really was to deal with a lot of the misinformation and fear-mongering that has been driven by various parties, political parties and others. This misinformation and these fear-mongering campaigns have probably generated a lot of comment, a lot of opposition, and certainly I know of petitions to oppose the bill. But the misinformation campaign has, in our view, been extremely divisive, and it has undermined the legitimacy of petitions and comments where those have been generated based on this misinformation. And we think this is a great disservice to the people of South Africa. So to start with, the campaign that the expropriation bill allows ANC officials to seize anything you own, the answer is obviously no. The purpose of this bill is set out in the preamble, and that is to provide for the expropriation of property for a public purpose or in the public interest, and to provide for certain instances where expropriation with no compensation may be appropriate in the public interest, and to provide matters that are connected therewith. Chairperson, this is not so different to the current law that was enacted in 1975, which was to provide for the expropriation of land and other property for public and certain other purposes. And the 2020 bill limits the minister's powers to expropriate. If you read Section 3 of the bill, the powers of the minister to expropriate are limited in terms of Section 3.1. The minister may expropriate property for a public purpose or in a public interest. So certainly that would not be to allow ANC members to seize whatever you own. And secondly, that the minister, in terms of Section 3.3, the minister's power to expropriate applies to property which is connected to the provision and management of the accommodation, land and infrastructure needs of an organ of state in terms of the minister's mandate. Chairperson, the bill also includes some protections that did not exist under the 1975 Act, and I'm referring to Clause 2.1, that despite the provisions of any law to the contrary, an expropriating authority may not expropriate property arbitrarily or for a purpose other than a public purpose or in the public interest. I go on to the next piece of misinformation, that the bill extends the meaning of property. This is incorrect. The current law, that enacted in terms of the 1975 Expropriation Act, defines property as including both movable and immovable property. So it is really the existing 1975 Act that expressly includes your cars, as some people have used to motivate opposition to this bill. In the 1975 Act, the property is defined as both movable and immovable property. I would like to deal with the third piece of misinformation, that the bill may allow anything to be taken in the public interest. Again, if you read Section 12.3, which is the big bone of contention for many people, expropriation with no compensation applies only to land. Section 12.3 reads exactly that. It may be just and equitable for no compensation to be paid where land is expropriated in the public interest. I would like to deal with the question of public interest, because there was arguments being made and campaigns being driven that public interest can mean anything, and that is certainly not the case. The Constitution and Section 25.4 provides that public interest includes the nation's commitment to land reform and to reform to bring about equitable access to all South Africans' natural resources. Chairperson, I'd like to deal with the question around will the government be taking my land and leave me with a mortgage bond? I think the answer to that is no, as set out in Section 18.1 of the bill, which deals with properties that are subject to mortgages or bonds. And I would submit to the committee that no compensation would never be regarded as just and equitable where property is encumbered by a mortgage bond. Chairperson, the question around do I lose my rights to oppose an expropriation, again, the answer is no. And the current 1975 law requires a disputing party to approach the court. So if you are a land or property owner and you dispute the compensation amount, you need to go to court, and that is set out in Section 5 of the 1975 law, where in the 2020 bill, there are some protections for the owner, because it requires the expropriating authority to go to court to prove the compensation value. And this is set out in Section 21 of the expropriation bill. So in conclusion, Chairperson, my submission is already brief, that the expropriation bill can bring an end to the long debate around effective land reform, around fair compensation, and around expropriation without compensation or with no compensation, as is set out in the bill and as was set out in the Constitutional Court judgment. Chairperson, those who've solicited opposition to the bill by petitions or encouraging objections, Many of them have done so with misinformation, going as far as absurdly suggesting that the government is coming to take your car. And I think this whipping up of fear is a great disservice to the people of South Africa. And with respect, Chairperson, I urge this committee to consider carefully how those who have submitted objections or submitted petitions have obtained those signatures. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brett, for your presentation, well detailed and also demystifying what is out there. Honourable members, any questions for clarities? Any questions for clarities? Hoping that Mr. Brett, you submitted this presentation. I know we did receive your written submission.
I did. Just to say, I did submit it orally, but I did submit it late last night.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We really appreciate your time and the presentation. Rato will be presenting.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to present this morning. My name is Lerato Bowe. I'm from General Manager from the South African Institute of Valuers. The South African Institute of Valuers is the largest voluntary association of property valuers in South Africa and represents more than half of the registered valuers in South Africa. However, presenting on our behalf this morning is Mr. Saul du Toit. Mr. du Toit is a professional valuer with extensive expertise in this field. He's an Institute past president and fellow member with over 37 years experience in property valuations, an assessor in the Land Claims Court, and he serves as well as an expert valuer in the South African Revenue Services Tax Appeal Board. Saul, if you could please just come up for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Lerato. I'm online at the moment. Can I proceed?
You may. I can see you, so I just think it should be fine.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity and committee members. For making a submission on behalf of the Institute of Valuers, we did make a written submission of 31 pages, and I just want to emphasize some points on that. Our submission is from the angle of being the technocrats, basically being the people that will have to interpret the bill from a compensating perspective, because valuers are the people out there that will have to derive compensation offers for owners, also put compensation claims on behalf of owners. Our submission was largely assisted by retired Judge Hildenays, who was a part judge of the Land Claims Court. So a lot of the legal components of our submission was informed by Judge Hildenays. So I just want to supplement the submission by referring to a few aspects of the bill. In our submission, we refer to a number of technical points, and if members go through it, committee members, I'll see it is to try and make the bill a bit more workable, or to rephrase something that it takes uncertainty out of the question. For instance, the definition of a land parcel, we believe it must be better clarified. The same with the definition of property, because reference in the bill is made to land, land parcel and property, but it doesn't necessarily define all of them. So we believe it's important that these are all better defined, or a singular term used throughout the bill. Just at the outset, apologies, I didn't mention it, but the SA Institute of Values certainly supports this bill in its high time. I mean, we've made submissions, I think this is our fourth submission we've made over the past decade on various bills, and we would like the bill to come to fruition and be enacted. if we go to subsection 5, and I mean that deals with some of the obligations that is placed on parties in the information gathering, it deals with what information of value can gather from an owner. We believe that's a bit extensive because it will probably impose on the privileges of the owner and his right to information. We deal with in that part of the submission the part of the information which we believe should be made available, and those parts should be agreements of sale, lease agreements, building plans, improvements, and those type of details should be made available. But I think the moment one starts an owner about his financial records, you go to an area where I think he has a right to refrain from that. So we made a submission in that regard. Under Section 7, basically that section deals with the intention to expropriate. The notice of the intention to expropriate under Section 7-2G3, it refers to how this notice will be delivered. We believe in it should be extended to also include email delivery, as currently you often find that these notices do not arrive at the right parties. And I speak from a personal experience where I assist the Department of Water and Sanitation with the expropriations in Clan William. And with a number of owners, we had difficulty basically serving notices because it couldn't be delivered by means of a postal delivery. And it was sometimes difficult to get hold of these owners for physical delivery. But we did have the email addresses, and it would be good if that's written into the bill. Under Section 7.4, 7.6 and 7.7, a lot of time obligations are placed on owners to submit certain pieces of information within certain time frames. We believe that a similar obligation should be placed on the expropriation authority to also comply with time frames, that it's not on the one side only, but from both perspectives. And I think an important thing, and one of the earlier speakers also spoke about it, Section 8.2c, that basically deals with the expropriation notice. A copy of that should be served at the deeds office. That must become an obligation, because if that's an obligation, it may result in an expropriation notice that was served, but that was never endorsed against the title of the property. So, and that could create incredible confusion if a person deals with that property in the future and cannot pick up that property has actually been expropriated. So there must be an obligation on the expropriation authority to immediately serve it at the deeds office or within a prescribed period of time. Section 85A and B deals with the notice that serve and basically the office of compensation. Now, the way we read it, it appears if this notice will include, say, there's a number of property owners and a number of right holders that's affected by a particular expropriation. It appears from the subsection, if a single notice will be served on all of them, providing detail of compensation to each and everyone. This could create significant confusion because compensation to one party may be significantly different to the compensation to another party for various reasons. I mean, the one person may have particular circumstances which justify or lesser compensation. So if a collective notice is served on all these parties, showing the different compensation amount, it's going to create a situation where people are going to compare compensation to with each other, and that's going to create a confusion, and it's going to create a situation where people are not going to accept compensation because they would all obviously then aim to have the highest compensation. So what we try and propose is that such notice should be served individually on the particular owners and on the particular right holders. The next section we'd like to, I would just like to place emphasis on is section 12, which deals with determination of compensation. I think that is for us as property values the most important section and how to interpret that section. Now 12.1 reads, I mean that is as per the constitutional provision, but I think what we as values would like to see additionally is a timing to this notice. Because if, what you often find in expropriation is that property is expropriated. In terms of the old Act, it states compensation must be based as on the date of notice. The current bill does not have that provision. If you do not tie compensation to a time, it can drag on and it can create significant problems, because if you do not have a time to the date of to the compensation, where do you draw the line? So we would propose that added to that section 12.1 is added as at the date of notice of appropriation. Adjusting equitable compensation must be determined, so that we can fix it to a time period. Chairperson, as you will notice, I mean, our concerns are more about the technical implications, because if you do not have a timing, it creates a difficult situation. What we also would like perhaps the committee to consider is, you know, under the old 75 Act, there's a provision for solatium. We realize it's not part of Section 25 of the Constitution, but solatium is, you know, it's a Latin word, and it's there for solace, and it's more for the poorer person, the less affluent person, to make an ex gratia payment based on a sliding scale to this person. Currently, solatium has been paid by the Land Claims Court, but that is after various submissions have been made to the court on the injustices a person may have suffered, and according to that, the court then makes an award of solatium in terms of the Restitution Act. But if we do not have a solatium provision in the current bill, that means if a person then wants to claim solatium for normal expropriation, that person will every time have to go through a whole court process to try and motivate such a solatium. So we would like to suggest to the committee to perhaps consider a small solatium percentage similar to the old scales that were used under Section 12.2 of the old Act to accommodate the people that are expropriated, because there's an inconvenience and there's a cost to these parties when they're expropriated, which is often not considered by the expropriator or the expropriating authority. Similarly, the current compensation refers to Section 25.3. You know, it must be just and equitable, and that must have regard to all relevant circumstances. And then it refers to the circumstances as contained in 25.3, but it doesn't deal with actual financial losses. Now, the old Act has a provision for actual financial losses, and that is something that is reasonable. One can say, yes, it is a relevant circumstance, but what we've experienced in South Africa from the Value General's Office, when they do compensation determination, they never look at actual financial losses the owner may suffer. And a typical actual financial loss, say, for instance, a handicapped person in a wheelchair's house is expropriated for a road widening. That person will now have to go and find a replacement property. But there will be a cost for that person to refit their new house that they buy to make it wheelchair friendly. That would be an actual financial loss. So if there's not a provision for actual financial loss in the bill, it may be interpreted that it shouldn't be considered. Yes, compensation must be just and equitable, but sometimes it appears if the officialdom of government, when they deal with compensation, has a very narrow interpretation of what is just and equitable, and they disregard any potential financial loss this party may suffer. So we want to suggest to the committee to perhaps consider to additionally bring in financial loss, actual financial loss suffered by a party as a potential claim heading. We also looked at 12.3, the areas under which null compensation may be considered. Now, speculative purposes, we're not sure. I mean, a lot of properties are held and then eventually developed. So it's impossible for an economy to develop all properties to the full immediately. So you will always have properties that's held for a time being. And we were wondering what's the reason for that provision in the bill. Is it perhaps to prevent people from speculating with property that may be expropriated? And we made a suggestion to rephrase that where land is was held, was acquired for, with the expectation that it would be expropriated and purely for the purpose of profiting from the compensation to be awarded for the expropriation. Perhaps rephrase that. Also, abandoned property, I listened to an earlier speaker, Professor Blessy, and our concern was, for instance, you may find the property is not necessarily abandoned willingly by owner, but the property may be hijacked. How do you deal with it in that circumstances? Also, under the health and, under section 12.3e, which deals with a property that is the nature condition, pose a health and safety or physical risk to people, we do have adequate legislation that covers it, and that provision should probably be slightly amended to say if a party doesn't respond to, to his obligation, yes, then that can it can be employed. A further area which we believe should perhaps just have an addition and which I just want to highlight is if one goes to section, pardon me, Chairperson, I just want to find myself on my submission, page 24. If we go to yes, the liability under section 18.4 municipal property rights and the like. That is clearly always a challenging factor. As I said, we dealt with the Glen William Dam recently and we found that is a problem area. And especially, yes, the previous speaker also said there must be a rights clearance certificate before the owner is compensated. Otherwise, any outstanding rights must be subtracted from compensation. But what we would like to add, in addition to rights and taxes, property rights and taxes, to also include that all other levies and charges should be paid up. For instance, homeowners association levies or sectional sectional title schemes and communal property association. It should not only be limited to rights and taxes, but also to any levies outstanding. We would like to propose that to commit to the committee. We thank you for the time. To listen to us and the opportunity to make the submission. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Just at the end of your time, any questions for clarity, honourable members? Any questions for clarity? In the absence of the hands, thank you for your presentation, which is very clear and with some recommendations. We are taking all the presentation we'll discuss as the committee when we sit together. Thank you again. We now invite Ms. Anne Benstein for the Center for Development and Enterprise. Oh, okay, she's here. Ms. Anne, the floor is yours. You have 15 minutes to give us your presentation on whether you support the bill or you are opposing the bill with the reasons and explanations that you have prepared. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you see me? Can you see my slide?
We can see you, not to the slides that you have. I think they must... Nola, can you give her the hosting rights so that she can show us the slides?
Oh, okay.
But we do have your presentation with us.
Okay, if I can just... Sorry, if we can just sort that out, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, it's already done, so Ms. Benstein can just flag the presentation.
Yeah, sorry, I just need to find, if you'll give me a minute, I'm just done something wrong here. Sorry about this. I need to share my screen. That's what I need to do. Okay, Madam Chair, can you see the slide?
Yes, Ms. Anne, we can see that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I really appreciate it. We have made a written submission, and we appreciate this time to summarize the essence of it and take any questions today. Now, CDE's interest in this bill is based on considerable work we have done in land reform over the last 15 years, and also the policy choices that are essential for the country to achieve faster and more inclusive growth and many more jobs. And both of these critical goals are affected by this bill. So my presentation departs from the written submission that CDE made in February 2021. The written submission was made on the basis of the expropriation bill, read with the proposed amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution that was current in February. Since then, as all of you know, there have been significant changes to the proposed amendment to Section 25. My presentation then will be in two parts: comments on the bill, assuming no amendments made to Section 25, and comments on the bill, assuming that the current proposed amendments to Section 25 may pass. It's important to state up front that for a whole lot of reasons, the CDE believes it is undesirable and unnecessary to change South Africa's constitution. Now, expropriation is something that happens in almost all societies, and it's a necessary evil. Without the power of expropriation, development can be held hostage by landowners so that forced sale to government must be legally possible. So the need for this bill and the amendment of the Bill of 1975 is one that we support. Expropriation is, however, a dangerous power. If overused, it can dramatically undermine economic growth by deterring investments. So expropriation must be used sparingly and in full accordance with the law that permits expropriation only in the public interest. Compensation must be just and equitable. This is essential for expropriated owners and for confidence in property rights. It's also important to appreciate that paying compensation by the state constrains their ability to use expropriation too much. Now, assuming no change to the Constitution, in our view, the expropriation bill is broadly workable. It does a reasonable job of balancing the need for the power of expropriation and imposing limitations on that. The critical challenge is not really a legal one. We are very concerned that the provisions of this bill will be misunderstood by expropriating authorities around the country and or deliberately abused by corrupt politicians or officials. It's for this reason that we are proposing essential amendments to tighten the bill, to increase clarity about what it does and does not provide, and to sanction misuse or abuse of expropriation. Now, the bill makes clear that no compensation is intended to be the exception and not the rule. And that's important to stress. But the bill does not limit expropriation for no compensation to expropriation affected for the purposes of land reform. When we made our submission, this was in the constitutional amendment, but it's not there if the constitutional amendment does not pass. So in our view, we are asking the committee to consider that this deficiency must be rectified if there is no constitutional amendment. No compensation should not be permissible for expropriation except for land reform and in circumstances that are exceptional. In addition, we would suggest strongly that the bill should define land reform by reference to restitution and redistribution as contemplated in Section 25 of the Constitution. Now, as I've said, it's likely that some officials will think that the law empowers more expropriation than it actually does. There is also the danger, a real danger, of corrupt misuse of this extraordinary power. Now, the problem cannot be resolved solely through legal amendments, but the bill should be strengthened to make the limits more explicit and to sanction misuse. In our view, it is important to make clear in the bill that availability of funds has no bearing on the determination of just and equitable compensation. So if a city council doesn't have enough money, they then say, oh, we're just going to expropriate for no compensation. That needs to be disallowed in the bill. The bill needs to require compensation of expropriated holders for the costs imposed by the expropriation itself. For example, the cost of getting a new home or moving to a new home. We are proposing severe legal consequences, criminal and civil, if officials expropriate in bad faith. And procedures defined in the bill should apply only to immovable property. This is an area in which there's been considerable misunderstanding and a lot of discussion, but we are saying the bill can eliminate a lot of that misunderstanding if it's defined to apply only to immovable property. Now, Madam Chair, you will see at the end of our slides, we have drafted the amendments to the expropriation bill for the committee to consider. We have attached those here. But what if the Section 25 is amended? Let's look at that. In our view, no amendment to Section 25 is needed, and it is bad policy to change the Bill of Rights. In 2020, the draft amendment to Section 25 would not have made fundamental changes to the basic architecture of South African property rights. The 2021 draft amendment is badly drafted and will result in serious adverse consequences for the country and for land reform. Two significant changes are introduced, and I will deal with each of them in turn. So the current amendment to Section 25 introduces subsection 4A about safeguarding the land as a common heritage for future generations. It is our view this is abstract and ambiguous language which will create enormous uncertainty about how case law will develop. What does it actually mean to safeguard the land as a common heritage for future generations? Does this mean that the state has a duty to stop development that might derogate from the use that future generations might obtain from the land? In our view, this is going to generate a lot of litigation that will slow development, make development more risky, raise costs, and reduce investment in our economy. How do courts decide in the face of complex, contradictory legal and scientific evidence? We would anticipate all manner of legal challenges to the use of land that can only delay and frustrate both land reform and essential development, such as infrastructure. It will add uncertainty and cost. It will do this for private landowners, but also for all levels of the state. What about the other problem area? And this is the introduction of state custodianship over certain land. This is a new idea for South Africa. Now, if a state owns land, it has all the rights that a custodian would have. So what does state custodianship over certain land mean? This must imply custodianship over land that somebody else owns. This is completely undefined in law. Can owners sell their land if they can find a buyer? Would there be any buyers under custodianship? Can their children inherit land and the family home? Can owners decide how to use the land within the confines of existing zoning rules? Who is responsible for maintaining the land? In our view, this amendment to the Constitution would create enormous uncertainty, reducing investment in land and immovable property, and reducing the value of all land in the country and all property. Think for a moment if you're a beneficiary of land reform that only gets state custodianship of the land. Are you now a second-class citizen? Certainly does not fulfill the promise the ANC has given South Africa for decades of equal property rights with other citizens to all those who were so disadvantaged during apartheid. Now, if subsection 5A is bad, the EFF's proposals can only be described as catastrophic. State custodianship over all land would turn everyone into a tenant. Tenants do not invest in property that belongs to their landlord. As somebody once said, have you ever washed a rented car? The state does not have the financial or technical capacity to invest in land, and property investment would collapse. In our view, state custodianship would reduce the value of land as an asset to zero, wiping out the balance sheet of households, businesses, and banks. Overnight, millions of people would become insolvent. A deep recession would be inevitable, and it may be hard to avoid the failure of one or more banks, which would be disastrous for all their customers and the country. So the new Section 25 amendment matters for this bill and the discussion this committee needs to have. Why? Well, in February 2021, the CDE submission was based on the amendment to Section 25 proposed at that time. If the new Section 25 amendment is passed, South Africa will have a new and radically different property rights regime. This expropriation bill operates within the context, under the umbrella of the country's constitution and Bill of Rights. Now, if that is changed by this amendment, the interpretation and operation of this draft bill could change significantly. It's important to remember that that South Africa's land reform challenge is not about expropriation. The bill does nothing to address the underlying problems of government capacity, competence, integrity, or the tiny amount of financial resources that have been allocated to land reform since 1994. In addition, to the extent that officials have themselves misunderstood what the bill allows for and what it does not, it could make things considerably worse with respect to land reform and with respect to South Africa's economic prospects. Let me conclude then. In our view, expropriation should be fair, legal, and rare. An expropriation for no compensation should be rarer still. Changing South Africa's constitution is undesirable and unnecessary. This bill is a workable balance of competing imperatives that we would argue it needs strengthening. We have to limit no compensation to land reform and then only in exceptional circumstances. Budget availability is not a factor in considering what is just and equitable. We must compensate expropriated owners for out-of-pocket costs, and we must limit the act explicitly to immovable property. Madam Chair, there is an enormous risk that officials will overuse and abuse this draft bill. If severe legal consequences need to be put into the bill for this, including personal civil liability to expropriated owners. My last word, and state custodianship must not be introduced into the Constitution. As you will see, we have drafted legal amendments to give effect to our proposals for the committee's consideration. Thank you very much for the time and the opportunity to make this presentation.
Thank you. Any questions for clarity, honourable members? In the absence of any hand, thank you again, Ms. Anne, for the Center for Development and Enterprise. We also have your presentation. It was sent to us. We will read it when we have to discuss in the committee. We thank you for your time. We now invite Agri Western Cape, Mr. Louis Vessels.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee and fellow stakeholders. Can I just maybe get a thumbs up if you can hear and see me?
Yes, we can hear you clearly.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to make oral submissions on the expropriation bill today. My name is Louis Vessels, and I will be making the submissions on behalf of the Western Cape. If you would allow me to just give a brief background regarding Agri Western Cape as an organization and what we do. We are a non-biased, apolitical federal organization and represents commercial farmers in the Western Cape. Currently, we have approximately 3,700 commercial agricultural producers as our members, spanning through the Western Cape area from the northwestern regions of Bitterfontein and Klipland all the way to the eastern regions of Maesberg, Wittenberg Bay and everything in between. The Western Cape is an extremely diverse agricultural sector spanning from intensive fruit farming to extensive livestock farming. Organized agriculture has represented these farmers for more than a century, and Agri Western Cape thus understands what the requirements for successful farming and food production in the Western Cape and South Africa is. Agri Western Cape would firstly like to categorically state that we support successful land reform that is implemented in a sustainable and successful manner. As the other speakers today, we have also submitted written submissions to which can be referred for further clarification and information. Chair, then I'm going to stand with that brief background and going to go straight to comments with regards to the act and concepts and wording therein, which the first is the determination of compensation. We want to submit that when determining compensation, market value of property must be the starting point. This gives a numerical anchor from which the question of what is just and equitable can be considered. If other relevant factors warrant the adjustment of the starting point, be that upwards or downwards, then the adjustment may take place. However, the primary purpose of compensation is to make the land owner whole, and a strong justification must be required for departure from the market price. The expropriating authority must be required to communicate any such justification to the landowner in or with the Section 8(1) notice of expropriation. We further want to emphasize that the value of a farm is not merely the land on which a farm is located. A farm is a going concern. Its value is made up not only of the land, but also capital equipment on the farm, the crops, livestock, as well as the skill and goodwill that is possessed by the farmer and the farm. We suggest that the bill must be amended to make clear that market value must include all these tangible and intangible assets. Chair, as you will see throughout our representation, because we represent commercial farmers, we will be looking at the bill through an agricultural perspective. We would further like to state that given the compensatory principle, a farmer that has his farm expropriated must be placed in a position where he can continue farming through the purchase of alternative land. This is of course necessary to ensure food security, but it is also necessary to protect the farmer's right to freedom of trade, occupation and profession. Chair, I would like to go to the next concept of law compensation, which is a concept that has been discussed widely today and is regulated by subsections 12, 3 and 4 of the Act specifically. Firstly, I would like to state that the concept of nil compensation is a powerful disincentive to investment. This is not an abstract proposition to our members. Understandably, no one wants to invest in a business that may be taken away for nothing. Subsection 2, 3A of the Act suffers a fundamental problem. If land is held to benefit from an appreciation in its market value, it almost by definition is valuable. If this land is taken away from the owner, then he has lost something of value. His compensation must not be without value. We thus recommend that the Section 12(3)(a) should be deleted or amended. A further point of concern within Section 12(3) is the term of is the term abandoned, which remains undefined in the bill. Under common law principles, a person loses ownership only if he exhibits a clear intention to abandon the property. The more valuable the property, the clearer this intention must be. Abandonment must be defined to remove any doubt that this high standard applies to abandonment of land under the Expropriation Act. An owner should only be deemed to abandon his farm when he exhibits a clear intention to abandon the property permanently. This brings me to Section 12(3)(d), which I would like to emphasize, and it states the following. Where the market value of the land is equivalent to or less than the present value of direct state investment or subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of land, this subsection remains deeply problematic for our Western Cape. In the first instance, given the substantial drop in state support for agriculture from the turn of the century onwards, most direct state investment in land acquisition and capital improvement occurred long ago. In most instances, the land that benefited from the improvement has been sold and resold. Some of the value of this land was attributed to state investment. The current owner in most cases paid for the value when he bought the property. It would be unfair to expect the current owner to shoulder the cost of state investment that he paid for when he bought the property. Subsection E should thus be amended to make it clear that it does not apply to instances where the current owner paid for the value of state investment that occurred before he bought the property. The subsection also refers to the present value of direct state investment or subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of land. This phrase is ambiguous and can, to our interpretation, mean one of two things. It can mean that the land value of the direct state investment or subsidy at the time that it was made, or to present value through an inflationary investment base or similar index, or it could simply mean the present value of the state investments or subsidy should it still have been value. The meaning of direct state investment or subsidy must be clarified. The definition must be inserted to make it clear that the subsection does not apply to direct relief, agricultural commodity price supports or similar state support. Chair, I would like to move on to the next concept of valuation. And there's also been given a thorough presentation being given on the valuation, but I would just like to quickly state our two concerns with regard to that. The provision of the Act that pertains to valuation, it remains concerning. It does not appear that that the expropriation authorities require to value the property before expropriating. Section 5.2b provides that an expropriation authority may, not must, but may authorize a valuer to value land. But if land is not properly valued, compensation cannot properly be determined. Section 5.2b must be amended to make it clear that the state must value land before it is expropriated. Failure to do so would render any expropriation unlawful in our opinion. If land is not valued, its market value cannot be addressed. It would also be unconstitutional under our current constitution. Section 25(3)(c) of the Constitution requires compensation to be determined with reference to all relevant circumstances, including the market value of land. Furthermore, Section 5.2b appears to permit the state to select a valuer. This may be an obvious conflict of interest. We thus submit that Section 5.2b should be amended to provide for the appointment of a valuer by an independent third party, such as the South African Institute of Valuers or the South African Council for the Property Valuation Profession, should there be a disagreement with regards to the valuer appointed by the state or the valuer general. So the next concept that we would like to discuss is the timing of compensation. The bill does not require compensation to occur before expropriation or simultaneous with it, or even shortly afterwards. Rather, it permits compensation to occur long after expropriation has occurred. I would like to emphasize Section 17.1 of the bill that provides that an expropriated owner or holder is entitled to payment of compensation at or before the expropriating authority obtains possession. But this requirement remains completely undermined by Section 73, which I would like to emphasize, and it states that any delay in payment of compensation to the expropriated owner or expropriated holder by virtue of Subsection 2 or any other dispute arising will not prevent the passing of the right to possession to the expropriated authority in terms of Section 9.2.4. Section 9.2 again provides that the expropriation authority must take possession of the expropriated property on the date stated in the notice of expropriation. So, okay, this is quite a mouthful, but what our take on that essentially is these provisions together mean that the expropriation authority can take possession of the expropriated property regardless of whether there is a dispute regarding expropriation, which might include compensation. This means that an unlawful expropriation stands until it is set aside by court. This means that a farmer could be dispossessed of his farm for years without adequate compensation while a dispute regarding with the expropriation authority wins through courts. In the worst case scenario, a farmer might not have the resources to challenge the expropriations in court at all. Without possession of his farm, he cannot generate these resources necessary to go through highly expensive court proceedings. So I would like to go on to the next concept, and that is land subject to a mortgage. If a property which is subject to a mortgage is expropriated, bill provides that the mortgage does not survive the expropriation. This is however not where it stops. The expropriation does not however extinguish the loan that was secured by the mortgage. So it's possible that a farmer could have his farm expropriated, thus lose the income with which to service the loan, and be given compensation that is not sufficient to pay it all. In this instance, the expropriation would leave him destitute and hopelessly indebted. Thus, a provision should be inserted to the effect that even expropriated property is subject to a mortgage, compensation cannot be less or limited to the outstanding balance of the loan that is secured by the mortgage. I would like to move on to the next concept, and that is compliance with time limits. In this regard, the bill contains various provisions that require officials to take decisions within specific times. No penalty is attached to non-compliance, however. We are extremely concerned that expropriating authorities may fail to comply with time periods set in the bill. This will stretch out the process of expropriation and place the landowner in a protracted and unacceptable state of uncertainty. The concern is not academic. Our members have experienced the land restitution process as one that is chronically beset with delay. Restitution claims often stall for years, discouraging the relevant owner from investing in his land and inhibiting his ability to use the land as security for credit. Of course, a lack of investment will also lead to a lack of economic growth, job security, and everything that goes with it. So, as concluding remarks, I would like to state that our experience in the agricultural sector has taught us two things. Farmers need policy certainty in order to invest in the sector and create growth. And through doing this, the second successful land reform will be achieved that contributes to food security and equality. So I thank you and the honourable members of the committee for the time to make a presentation, and you're welcome to ask any questions should there be any.
Thank you, Mr. Vessels from Agri Western Cape. Any questions for clarities, honourable members? Any questions for clarities, honourable members? In the absence of such, let's appreciate the presentation that you made to us, Mr. Vessels, and all that you are suggesting and advising us. We take all the information that is presented to us seriously and we'll discuss as the committee. Thank you for your time. We now invite Mr. Jan Bosman, who is representing Afrikaner Bond. Mr. Jan Bosman, you have 15 minutes to present your views on this important bill. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Jan Bosman. I'm the Chief Secretary of the Afrikaner Bond, and I'm speaking from our offices in Randburg. I want to thank you for the opportunity. It is a privilege for any citizen of this country to address a parliamentary portfolio committee and to speak frankly and honestly about honest issues affecting every South African. And I do so today on behalf of the Afrikaner Bond. My presentation will be in English and I will gladly answer questions that may arise. The Afrikaner Bond, just a short overview, is a member-based organization and will promote Afrikaner interests and to have branches all over South Africa. Our organization is 103 years old and we have also learned from mistakes in the past, but we have also had some proud achievements and we therefore submit that within our vision as Afrikaners, we help build the future of South Africa. We can bring some experience and also some knowledge which we provided in our comments. In Afrikaans, our vision is as Afrikaners by ons saam aan die toekoms van Suid-Afrika. And it is exactly for this reason that we are here today. We submitted our full and explanatory comments on the 27th of February 2000, this year. The Afrikaner Bond is also a member of and the convener of the Ad Hoc Group for the Protection of Property Rights. This is an informal grouping of organizations, civil institutions and political parties from across the political and societal spectrum that are opposed to expropriation without compensation and we promote property rights for all South Africans. Many of the individual organizations submitted their comments in this process and some are also making oral representations today. At the outset, it should be recorded that the Afrikaner Bond opposes any form of expropriation without compensation. One of the cornerstones of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights deals with property rights as contained in Article 17, and it states, one, everyone has the right to own property alone as well as in association with others, and two, no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his property, end quote. Therefore, the Afrikaner Bond has serious reservations on the proposed expropriation bill, and at the same time, we want to warn that this legislation will have far-reaching negative consequences for all South Africans. We are convinced, as the Afrikaner Bond, that land reform and the increase of access to property to all South Africans is of the utmost importance and needs to be addressed urgently and effectively. At our centenary celebrations on the 7th of June 2018, President Ramaphosa addressed us, and amongst others, he said, and I quote him, "Let us plan and determine the future of this country together. Let us seek the peace for the torn, tragic, divided South Africa." He said, if well handled, land reform will help bind the nation together and produce benefits for everyone. If badly managed, it will simply redistribute resentment, damage the economy, and destroy social peace. If not undertaken at all, the country will remain divided at its heart, unquote. Any state has the option to expropriate, and no one doubts that, and no one disputes this. It is our view that expropriation, when necessary, but without compensation, should be a measure of last resort. We further maintain that according to free market principles, the willing buyer, willing seller principle must be maintained, and that possible problems in the system must be addressed and not the principle. Why and how this bill came into being must be questioned, and the timing could not have come at the worst possible time with the economic climate and growing uncertainty by investors. Policy certainty is the foundation for investment and economic growth. Madam Chair, the bill's purpose, as we understand it, goes far beyond its objectives and opens the way to a virtually unlimited assault on the property rights of potentially all South Africans. I want to quote from the Institute of Race Relations in their submission to Parliament. They said that this bill will threaten the property rights of all South Africans, from the 9.5 million people with home ownership to the roughly 18 million with customary law plots and the estimated 17 million who belong to pension funds. They also said it will harm all business owners, both large and small, and at the same time, the economic fallout from this bill will further hurt the 11 million individuals now unemployed by reducing investment, limiting growth, and stalling post-lockdown recovery. Unquote. This expropriation bill is, in our considered view, part of an effort to nationalize private property. It should be emphasized that, in our view, any property is under threat and not merely land or agricultural land. In this regard, Professor Elminde Pessy of Northwest University wrote earlier this year in News 24, the expropriation bill is not only applicable to land. It might be useful to know, in terms of current law, it is also possible to expropriate limited real rights, personal rights, immaterial property rights, and so forth. The focus on land is largely because Clause 12.3, dealing with no compensation, and the constitutional amendment process only focuses on land specifically. End that quote. Of bigger importance to us is that this expropriation bill is arbitrary and irrational in the sense that it preempts the legislative process relating to the draft Constitution 18th Amendment Bill. We have proposed that the expropriation bill must be considered once the process relating to the draft Constitution 18th Amendment Bill has come to its final conclusion in the legislative process and the constitutionally has been judicially reviewed and verified. Although the expropriation bill is presented as if in the interests of the public, the provisions that follow are heavily laden with autocratic actions that would seem to benefit state organs. Many organizations make very thorough inputs in their submissions earlier and also during the course of the morning, and they highlighted the legal problems, the economic consequences, and also many valuable suggestions were made, which we hope this portfolio committee will consider. The expropriation bill, in our view, is formulated in such a way that the unlawful expropriation of property by the state is deemed lawful. This specifically refers to instances where compensation is less than the market value or the replacement value of the property, crops on the land, and specialized equipment. Madam Chair, even more problematic is the fact that the expropriation bill can establish a process according to which compensation may be as low as nil rand. The expropriation bill is aimed at empowering the state to unilaterally take away property rights and retain them itself. This, in our view, is a sugar-coated attempt at the nationalization of property, and we must warn against this. The circumstances under which property may be expropriated are not clear at all. This allows the state to expropriate property for any reason, as long as it is alleged to be expropriated in the public interest or for a public purpose. The expropriation bill does not impose an obligation on the state to explain or demonstrate how expropriation is justified in this public interest or for the public purpose. Subsequently, there is no burden of proof on the state to prove this important precondition. The burden of proof on the individual affected or prejudiced by the expropriation bill is consistently against the specific individual when the autocratic actions of the state are contested. I also refer you to our full submission. The negative effect of all forms of tax flowing from the expropriation bill is draconian and should be thoroughly analyzed. The impact on all elements of real economic activities should also be quantified. The actual true fiscal impact relative to the expropriation bill should not only be thoroughly analyzed and determined from a cost perspective, but also in respect of the tax receivable basis. It is clear in our view that unpopular intervening taxation legislation will have to follow, and I want to refer you to our written submission, which details the tax implications. In our view, and in our suggestion, rather abandon the current proposed bill and redraft the legislation taking into consideration all the submissions than to push ahead with a bill which in our view is undesirable and probably unconstitutional. Madam Chair, we maintain further that Section 25 of the Constitution constitutes a proper legislative framework for real land reform and that it should be used to speed up the land reform process. Furthermore, access to property for all South Africans must be done on a proper legislative basis and process, and based on sound principles and not on a basis to expropriate and to do so on the basis as foreseen in this draft bill. We end this oral submission with the powerful words in the November 2017 report of the high-level panel chaired by former President Kgalema Motlanthe, which reviewed and assessed the key legislation and the acceleration of fundamental change. He said in this report, the panel found that in many instances, the problems identified do not arise from the terms of the law per se, but rather from failures of implementation and enforcement. And I want to repeat it, rather from failures of implementation and enforcement. In our view, more draconian legislation will not solve the problem as highlighted by the former president. Madam Chair, the Afrikaner Bond wishes to thank the Portfolio Committee for this opportunity to be invited and to participate in this session of oral submissions. I thank you.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Any questions for clarity, honorable members? Honorable members, questions for clarity? In the absence of any questions for clarity, thank you, Mr. Jan Bosman, for your presentation. We're taking all that you're suggesting. We will discuss in depth when we are discussing as the Portfolio Committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We now invite the West Provincial Government Representative, MEC of Agriculture, Honorable Mayor. Over to you, sir. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Can you hear me? And am I audible?
Clearly, clearly.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Ivan Meyer, the MEC for Agriculture in the Western Cape, and I'm also the leader of government business in the Western Cape. We have submitted on behalf of the Western Cape Cabinet submissions, so I will just elaborate on some of it. The Western Cape has submitted our comments on the above bill on the 1st of February, and the Western Cape stated in its submission that it does not support the bill, both for the policy and legal reasons listed in our submissions and on the basis of technical comments as well. From the policy comments, I would like to highlight the following. The Western Cape government acknowledged that the redressing the distortions in property ownerships resulting from apartheid discriminatory regime is a constitutional and moral imperative, but whilst this is the case, any policy all legislative changes that affect property rights should be carefully considered for fear of unintended consequences. And if I listen to the careful presentations that was made here before me, they have highlighted the unintended consequences. Now, the bill is driven by the debate on the slow pace of land reform, and the policy position is that indicators of the pace of land reform is not only the rate at which the transfer of property happens, that is only one part of it. The rate of land reform should be determined in terms of the livelihoods created and supported and the economic value created rather than the size the hectares of land transferred. Now, expropriation requires the balancing of interest of the individual and that of the public. It is possible to consider the public interest in many ways. In the case of land reform, it needs to be considered against the immediate need to make progress towards a more equitable distribution of land, yes, but more importantly also to create and maintain the conditions for greater economic growth, investment and inclusive economic development. Now, the expropriation, Madam Chair, of land without compensation could have significant economic consequences for South Africa. These include a downgrade of the country's sovereign status to junk status, was mentioned in previous presentations, the higher interest rate, a sharp decline in taxation revenues, was also mentioned by previous speakers, and even a possible recession. Now, studies, Madam Chair, that was done on the implementation of similar policies in Portugal, Spain, Romania, Vietnam, Venezuela, Ethiopia, and Zimbabwe have all shown that the implementation of similar land reform policies have had a negative impact on the economies of those countries as well as the livelihoods of the vulnerable members of society. Well, a study, Madam Chair, was also done on this, and it found that countries that implemented similar policies experienced an average of 13.9% ratio decline in terms of the ratio between capital formation and GDP. And that's quite a massive decline when you look at the economic trends currently in South Africa, but also globally. An impact on GDP decline could translate into an escalation of finance requirements, which would in turn lead to a higher money market and capital market interest rates and higher costs of servicing debt. And we know what is the current debt-to-GDP ratio in South Africa, heading towards 80%. What that means, if you have a factory and your production is 100 rand, it means 80%, which is 80 rand, must go to servicing your debt, and the 20 is for your operational cost, an unbearable situation. Now, the bill was not well conceived in our view here in the Western Cape, and an impact assessment should be conducted. Now, the recapitalization and development program is a land reform and the agricultural support program, and we believe that if you want to do successful land reform, one needs to do a number of issues. Firstly, have proper land reform and allocate land to those people who want to farm and can farm. Secondly, have proper land restitution. Thirdly, land tenure. In other words, giving people titles. And fourthly, have proper land audits. Well, we know that the country does not have a proper land audit or land restitution. So those both cannot fix those deficiencies in other legs of land reform. Now, none of the findings of the evaluations appears to have been considered in the drafting of the bill. For example, the evaluation found that only 70% of farms included in the evaluation were productive at the time of the evaluation, and only 47% of the beneficiary farms had improved access to the market as a result of that land reform program. This bill, Madam Chair, is also vague as it does not give guidance. The bill confers in certain powers, certain provisions, wide powers on functionaries. The bill provides little to no guarantee on how these powers are to be exercised. This renders the bill vague to the extent that clarity and certainty cannot be ascertained from the rest of the provisions of the bill. In this regard, the bill does not meet the formal requirements of clarity and non-arbitrariness of law of general application. It also does not meet the constitutional principle of rationality. What constitutes property is central to the bill and its application. Madam Chair, the bill is an opportunity to provide a clear and a precise definition for property. The constitution merely describes property as not limited to land. This is understandable because the Constitution, Madam Chair, is pitched at a very wide level. The bill merely states that property is property contemplated in Section 25, Subsection 4 of the Constitution. The draft definition is unhelpful and misses the opportunity to provide clearly and precisely for what should be understood by the term property. Madam Chair, the Constitution provides that property must be expropriated for public purpose or in the public interest in terms of a law of general application. Now, the concept of public purpose is central to the structure of this bill. And the definition for public purpose in the bill reflects the Expropriation Act of 1975 to state that a public purpose is to include any purposes connected with the administration of the provisions of any law by an organ of state. Now, Madam Chair, this definition, inclusion of any purpose, renders the definition too wide, too broad. The Constitutional Court, it was referred to in some other submissions before the committee, so I won't go into that detail, but the Constitutional Court in the F&B case stated that Section 25 of the Constitution requires the expropriation cannot be arbitrarily. Madam Chair, Clause 2 of the bill provides that despite the provisions of any other law to the contrary, an expropriating authority, and that can be a municipality, can be a provincial authority, a national government department, may not expropriate the property of a state-owned corporation or a state-owned entity without the concurrence of the executive authority responsible for that corporation or entity. It is not clear why concurrence is required and state-owned entities are given this privileged position when expropriation is a compulsory taking. By requiring concurrence, state-owned entities are protected against compulsory acquisition of their property. It should be possible for any property and parcel of land to be expropriated, including land of state-owned corporations and entities. Madam Chair, clause 7 of the bill deals with the exchange of information between the expropriating authority and the owner. And Madam Chair, according to the scheme, the expropriating authority has by this point conducted a comprehensive valuation of the property, and the expropriating authority then sends a notice of expropriation to the owner. The notice appears not to be contained in any indication of the value of the property. The notice will call on the owner to submit a written statement stipulating the amount claimed by the owner as just and equitable compensation within 30 days. Madam Chair, what this means is that the owner must effectively make the first bid. Rationality in expropriation includes procedural fairness, and in this case, procedural fairness is being compromised here. Madam Chair, if you look at Section 12, Subsection 3C of the Expropriation Bill, it allows for the payment of no compensation where land, despite belonging to someone, has been abandoned because the owner has lost control of the land. We believe that this clause is an open invitation to land invaders who seek to force the government to provide land for housing opportunities. I would like the members of this committee to note that this is happening currently across South Africa, and in some places more than 1,000 land invasions has taken place in some cities here in the metropolitan areas across South Africa. So this will be open invitation for land invaders, and it is happening as we speak at this committee. So it is not hypothetical stuff, it is happening right as we speak. Throughout the country, Madam Chair, land invasions are becoming more and more prevalent. The clause basically incentivizes land invasions because the final result would be the expropriation of the land without compensation. Madam Chair, we fully appreciate that the land question has become a crisis in this country. We believe that land reform remains possible if done properly, fairly, and without corruption. The National Department of Land Reform is filled with corruption, maladministration and fraud, and they must deal with that issue rather than try to bring this bill to the Parliament. Madam Chair, I think also Section 12.3 of the Expropriation Bill allows for expropriation of land without compensation under certain conditions. Although this is also not a limited list, the section does not, however, address the question of mortgages that might exist on the properties in question, which is also of great concern. Madam Chair, I think members of the committee are aware that banks in South Africa are exposed to the tune of 1.6 trillion rand in mortgages. Now, the threat of expropriation without compensation could create a banking crisis which could collapse the economy completely. And if the banks collapse, we will not be able to have a financial institution. If the banks collapse, the economy will collapse. In fact, if there are no banks in South Africa, all members of parliament will have to be paid in cash. There won't be a banking system to transfer your salary. If expropriation without compensation occurs on a property which has a mortgage, the owner of the property remains liable for the mortgage. However, without the property to act as a surety for the mortgage, there's little to no hope of the bank getting its money back. And that's what will lead to a complete collapse of the banking system. Honorable Madam Chair, I think if we look at internationally, expropriation plan is also against the Human Rights Charter of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 70, which reads, everyone has the right to own property alone as well as in association with others. Clause 2 of the International Charter reads, no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his property. So, Madam Chair, expropriation in particular, if there is such an angle, without compensation, is illegal in international law. And international law is the superior law. It takes precedence over municipal or national law. And therefore, we reject this bill, Madam Speaker, because we have seen the impact of what has happened before in terms of other countries that went this route. Madam Chair, I want to conclude. Is it possible to just have one slide to share it with the committee? If I can have access to share the screen.
But please note that you have 1:30 left.
That's Mr. Nanda,
please assist him in giving him hosting rights.
Long time, Chen.
Can you see it now, madam?
There's nothing on screen, sir.
Okay. Let me then rather conclude by saying that we reject the bill. I think there are two options. One is a system that will take your property without compensation. The citizens will rent the property. The state will own your property and you will become landless. There's an alternative where people must keep their property within the constitutional dispensation, respect the investment, respect the improvement on the investment, support successful land reform where the citizens own their property, not rent the property, give them successful title deeds, and you become the landowner of such property. That's our proposal. Therefore, the Western Cape Cabinet rejects the bill before the committee. I thank you for this opportunity, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation on behalf of the government, Mr. Ivan Meyer. Any questions for clarities, honorable members? Any questions? We appreciate your presentation, honorable MEC, and we will discuss this at length when we are discussing all the presentations as the portfolio committee. We will now invite the EFF. The presentation will be done by Honorable Matthias. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. On behalf of my organization, we're happy to have this opportunity to once more clarify the position of the EFF on the land expropriation without compensation, which is a foundational pillar for our political program for economic freedom in this lifetime. The founding manifesto of the EFF states categorically that in order to attain our state objective of economic freedom in our lifetime, the land must be expropriated without compensation for equal free distribution and use. Further, the founding manifesto proclaims that land belongs to all and should therefore never be owned only by those who have power and resources to buy land. There must be a decisive effort to commodify land so that it truly becomes a public resource available for use to all. It is for this reason that we led a motion in February 2018 in the National Assembly calling for the amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution to allow for land expropriation without compensation. The original amended motion agreed upon by the National Assembly in 2018 instructed the Constitutional Review Committee to do, amongst others, one, review and amend Section 25 of the Constitution to make it possible for the state to expropriate land in the public interest without compensation, and in the process conduct public hearings to get the views of ordinary South Africans, policymakers, civil society organizations and academics about the necessity of and mechanism for expropriating land without compensation. Two, to propose the necessary constitutional amendment with regards to the kind of future land tenure regime needed, taking into account the necessity of the state being a custodian of all South African land. While the constitutional amendment process has now been comprehensively hijacked by reactionary elements within the ruling party and ignored almost all of these recommendations, we are not going to tire and will do all we can to see expropriation of land without compensation attained in our lifetime. The expropriation bill that we are talking about today is a continuation of the sell-out arrangement by the ruling party and offers no significant departure from the way things have always been. Firstly, it was cheeky of the Department of Public Works to publish this bill while the other committee was busy with the process of amending Section 25 of the Constitution to allow for the expropriation of land without compensation. Secondly, the bill is still rooted in the reactionary provisions of Section 25 in as far as compensation for expropriation is concerned. Section 12 of the bill deals with compensation for expropriation and lifts all the factors outlined in Section 25, subsection 3 of the Constitution as key determinants for compensation. Section 12, subsection 3 of the bill, which speaks about a vague concept of nil compensation, is only a strategy to fool South Africans into thinking that something is being done to resolve the problem of land hunger in this country. The bill provides for only limited instances in which expropriation can happen without paying compensation. And these are for land that would be useless to the majority of our people. It makes no sense whatsoever to proclaim that you will pay nil compensation for land that is not productive, which is abandoned, owned by the state, or dangerous for human habitation, as the bill proposes. We want a legislative mechanism that will allow for expropriation of land without compensation in city centers where our people are desperate in need of housing, in farmlands where farm workers and farm dwellers have been evicted with no sense of shame since Europeans took over our land. We want to discontinue the commodification of land, as land is a common heritage of all of us and should be under the custodianship of the state. Our argument on state custodianship of land is premised on the imperative of decolonizing our society and of effecting thoroughgoing, deeper level transformation of power and conceptions of power in society. To this end, land remains the most important embodiment of power, of identity, of belonging. Our conception of land and its relation to the structuring of power and influence in society is therefore critical if the ultimate aim is to usher in a more egalitarian society free of exploitation and oppression. The difficulty most liberal academics and policymakers have with the notion of the discontinuation of private ownership of land emanates from the deeply ingrained capitalist notion that views land as commodity that can be owned, bought and sold. The Marxist tradition from which the EFF draws its inspiration rejects this notion of private ownership of what is essentially a public resource. The very conception of private ownership of land is at the root of inequality. It facilitates the exploitation of one class by the other, and its continuation cements inequality. An entrenched system of private ownership of land allows for a few individuals to accumulate and consolidate more land over a period of time, to the exclusion of a great majority of our people. Nowhere is this more apparent in South Africa than in the consolidation of agricultural land over the past two decades. In 1993, South Africa had 58,000 commercial farming units. In 2002, this number had been reduced to 45,880. In 2007, the number was 39,965. And today, it is estimated the country just has under 35,000 commercial farming units. This is not as a result of a reduction in agricultural land. but the direct consequence of a capitalist system of accumulation and consolidation. A few farmers, trusts and corporations with more money have bought and consolidated more land onto a few hands. With the volatility of trade and the continued reluctance of the South African state to protect and subsidize the agricultural sector, this number of farmers is certain to be reduced. The result is larger farms and fewer owners. At a conceptual level, the idea of private ownership of land has never been proven to work anywhere in Africa and is alien to African customary law. A contemporary notion of ownership are derived from Western jurisprudence. This, an African scholar, Achima Mafeje, argues that it leads to a series of misconceptions, particularly over the notions of ownership of land and viewing land as property. Mafeje further argues that the Western conception of land as property refers to a delineated portion of the physical solar and confer jurisdictional as well as executive control on the holder. Contrasting that with African land tenure system, he argues that African jurisprudence recognized rights of possession determined by prior settlement and membership given to social group, user rights contingent on social labor, and rights of social exchange underscored by implicit revisionary rights. He further adds that land rights could be recognized in any of these forms, but not individual ownership of land. From both an African customary perspective and from a progressive radical Marxist perspective, the discontinuation of private ownership of land becomes a primary requisite for both the decolonization of a new colonial socio-economic setup, for redressing inequitable and racial distribution of land, and for ensuring sustained state-directed, state-led development for the benefit of the majority of South Africans. A progressive state, therefore, must be able to be the embodiment of our people's aspiration for freedom and liberty, and after capturing control of the land of the country, be strategically positioned to redistribute this equitable for use, be that residential, agricultural, or for industrial purposes. The taking over of the means of production, and particularly of land, requires therefore a state that is conscious of its revolutionary responsibility. The failure of any state to fully execute their revolutionary responsibility is described by Fanon as follows. I quote, the national middle class which takes over power at the end of the colonial regime is an underdeveloped middle class. It has practically no economic power, and in any case, it is in no way commensurate with the bourgeois of the mother country with its hope to replace it. In its willful narcissism, the national middle class is easily convinced that it can advantageously replace the middle class of the mother country. But that same independence which literally drives it into a corner with which will give rise within its rank for catastrophic reactions and will oblige it to send out frenzied appeals for help to the former mother country, close quotes. The vacillation of the ruling elite in resolving the land question vindicates Fanon's description of the handicap of the class that takes over power from the oppressors. Any legislative process, Madam Chair, including this bill and the constitutional amendment bill, that does not take into account the need for a thoroughgoing, deeper level transformation of even our conceptions of land without, which would only be superficial and would not lead to broad-based redistribution of land and would certainly not lead to decolonization. These artificial amendments would not be transformative by any stretch of imagination, as they would transfer large, sometimes unproductive estates exactly because they are large to an elite group of the black bourgeoisie. State custodianship of land, Madam Chair, must mean broad-based redistribution of land to people who can use it for its social and economic purposes. That is production, residential use, and industrial development. That redistribution is not that of land, but of land use rights as well, in the form of leaseholds and other forms of socially developed means of securing tenure. For state custodianship of land to be of transformative importance to our people, a capable state is needed, which must be able to provide strategic direction, technical expertise, and ensure transparency. In conclusion, Madam Chair, the EFM firmly stands by its call for unity of all progressive forces, taking up the fight for land expropriation without compensation, to bring victory of economic freedom closer to the Azanian people. This is a battle far from being lost. The bill, as it stands, is not taking our struggle for land forward, and we call on all progressive forces in this country and elsewhere to reject it. Thank you so much, Honourable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Matthias, for your presentation, representing your political party. We will discuss it as the portfolio committee, like other presentations that we have received. We appreciate the time that you have spent with us. Any questions for clarities, Honourable Members? Any questions for clarity? In the absence of the questions for clarity, thank you again, Honourable Matthias. We appreciate your time. We will then call upon the ANC Gebisa Shapiro branch, were led by Ms. Safura. There's also Ms. Mumalo, there's Ms. Tim and Ms. Mpila, Mr. Mpila, Mr. Tim and Ms. Mpila. I think there are four, but I think Ms. Safura will be the one leading the team. You are welcome in this platform. You have 15 minutes to present your view on this important bill. Over to you, the platform is yours.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee. On behalf of the ANC Gabby Shapiro branch, which operates in the Western Cape province, we want to thank you for this opportunity to make an oral submission on the bill. We have made presentations in the public hearings as well, both as a branch, but the ANC broadly as an organization. So I think to start off, needless to say, the ANC Gabby Shapiro branch unambiguously supports the enactment of this bill into legislation. We would like the bill to be passed into legislation as soon as is practically possible. And our reason for this and our support is based on two key factors. The one is that the bill gives effect to our when we addressing issues of access to property and land. We also believe that it gives effect to our constitutional obligations regarding social justice, which I will not elaborate on here because it was quite adequately explained by Professor Thuli Madonsela when she made her presentation to the committee. The second reason is that there is a very urgent need to repeal the existing Expropriation Act No. 63 of 1975. What we do find a little bit perturbing is that people who do not, and organizations, political parties, individuals who do not support this Bill 23 of 2020 refer to Act No. 63 of 1975 at times. And there's two things they're failing to acknowledge. One is that Act 63 of 1975, which continues to be used by government in the absence of an amended act or a repeal of the act, is essentially unconstitutional because that act, 63 of 1975, as we all know, was promulgated during the era of apartheid rule in our country. and that it then served the expropriation interests of the apartheid government of the day. We know, and again this was explained by Professor Thuli Madonsela in much more detail, that system was based on racial inequalities that deprived the vast majority of our people, their political, their social, their economic and human rights, basically justice. So this, we believe, is an important point to remember. For those who oppose the passage of Bill 23 into an act on the focusing on the element of no compensation, what they also fail to acknowledge and recognize is that Act 63 of 1975, which is unconstitutional in the current dispensation and has been unconstitutional since 1994, does in fact also make provision for expropriation with no compensation. And that in Act 63, it's Section 91B of the Act that speaks to this issue. So it is actually a misrepresentation by some individuals and parties when they say that this act is introducing no compensation as a new idea, or they are suggesting that the bill in its entirety is a new concept when it is something that has been practiced by the apartheid government over the years, but has been done so in a way that has favored a minority of people and not the majority. While we do support the bill, we believe that there are certain areas that need to be strengthened. Again, we have logged in and listened to various presentations, and we believe that all political parties, particularly those represented in Parliament, have a political and a constitutional responsibility to listen and to take into account the proposals that will enact the bill but make it workable around some of the concerns that have been raised. So we come from a place where we hear the concerns that have been raised. We accept some of those concerns, and you will hear it later in our presentation, but we believe that in order for us to be operating within the framework of the Constitution broadly, not just in relation to Section 25, that all political parties present in Parliament have a responsibility to see how the weaknesses and gaps can be addressed, and not to propose or come from a position where they throw out the bill because there's weaknesses and gaps. So to kickstart one of those weaknesses, on talking of one of those weaknesses that need to be addressed, we are proposing that the preamble of the bill, which currently repeats Section 25 of the Constitution as it is now, that should be deleted, and that what should be inserted instead is that, you know, that we add two clauses where we talk about the lack of available land for implementation of government socioeconomic development programs, which is impeding the delivery of a just and democratic South Africa. So that principle should be inserted in the preamble. And the second principle is the principle linking to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Persons, which speaks to states providing redress and to which South Africa is a signatory. So I will stop at that point and hand over to my colleague, Ms. Busi Mumalo, will take you through our second proposal. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. So building on that, the second part of it that we want to make an amendment to is specifically on the purpose of the bill. So on the purpose of the bill, we are on the view that the purpose is not explicit in terms of explaining Bill 23 of 2020 is being considered for the enactment. We therefore propose, as the currently worded, is deleted and replaced with the following. One, this expropriation bill 23 of 2020, the first amendment is that the repeals of the Expropriation Act number 63 of 1975 that resulted in the disproportionate and distribution and inequitable access to land. The two, gives effect to the following sections of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa under Act 108 of 1996, which is Section 25 that then provides the redress of the past of racially discriminatory laws of practices of land pertaining to land. The second is that on Section 33.1 that provides for the lawful and reasonable proportionally fair administration, and on Section 34 that provides everyone the right to any disputes to be resolved in a fair public hearing before a court or an independent or an impartial tribunal or forum. The other point is enables expropriation of the land in accordance with the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land in the Republic of Africa. Also enables government to expropriate land on two points. The first is that the purpose of public goods and interests, which result in an equitable socio-economic development of growth of Republic of Africa. The second is the nil compensation under the circumstances which are defined in Chapter 5 and 12.3 in the bill for public interest and for the public purpose, and provides the masses in connection with therefore. I'm now going to hand over to my other colleague, Mr. Tim Dunn. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Just have a few comments with regards to the definition of public property, public purpose and court, as well as one or two comments with regards to the mitigation and prevention of litigation around this bill once it becomes an act. The main thrust of the proposed amendments in terms of the definition section of the bill pertain to property, public interest and the court, based on three principles with regards to the bill. It deals with the issue of expropriation of land and movable property, and not with personal property such as cars, pensions, bank accounts, etc., in order to deal with intellectual property, things like copyright, trademarks, patents, etc. Secondly, explains that expropriation with or without compensation will be solely for the purpose of socio-economic development as is described as public interest and a public purpose in the bill. And thirdly, when enacted, the implementation of the bill will require collaboration and coordination with various sister departments across all spheres of government. And I'd also really at this point say now that includes, at this point in the drafting stage, to make sure that there's synergy between different acts that already find application, things like the Deeds Registries Act, and any form of legislation that pertains to property, zoning, heritage, etc., that there is synergy, because otherwise it will create a recipe for litigation going many years, and is not something that will benefit anyone economically or socially. The first definition pertains to property. Currently, the definition of property in the bill means that property is contemplated in Section 25 of the Constitution. As stated by Comrade Sefura in her introduction, tying the definition to Section 25 of the Constitution, which is under consideration for amendment, could delay the enactment of this bill. Thus, we are proposing that the definition as it stands should be deleted and replaced with something much along the lines of the following. Property meaning, for the purposes of this Act, immovable property that is suitable and appropriate for purposes of public good and or in the public interest. We then move to the definition of public purpose, which is currently defined in the bill as including purposes connected with the administration of the provisions of any law by an organ of state. Our proposal is that this be amended to read any purposes connected with advancing the equitable socio-economic development of the country. Amending the definition in this way will close the gap for endless litigation and court cases on whether the expropriation was indeed connected with the administration of law and how the administration serves a public purpose or is in the public interest. It will also ensure that property is not expropriated for corrupt or other nefarious purposes other than its main purpose and objective, which is to expropriate land and other immovable property in pursuance of the country's land reform and socio-economic development priorities. The next point deals with the definition of a court. And in this scenario, firstly, I must point out that already there is provision in the 1975 Act for a court to pronounce upon matters of expropriation, so this is nothing new. And all that we suggest here is that the word court provide for and include a land court. We know that we already have the Land Claims Court, and we suggest that the Act simply fall under the Land Claims Court. It already deals with matters of evictions from rural land, and it obviously deals with matters of land claims in terms of the Restitution of Land Rights Act as amended, one of the best pieces of legislation in the world pertaining to land. We also believe that Clause C under the definition of court must be deleted in its entirety because it speaks to intangible property, which we understand is not within the remit of this bill. Clause C currently says, in the case of intangible property, the court, etc. Intangible property, using a legal definition, refers specifically to non-physical substances or concepts such as brand identity, intellectual property being patents, copyrights, trademarks, licenses. And it's important to note that this bill focuses on the expropriation of property and land and does not deal with intangible property, and thus Clause C must be removed. In this regard as well, we're not saying that there shouldn't be any view to perhaps being able to at some point in time have the authority to expropriate intangible property, but this act is not the time or the place for that. And there are numerous other acts that deal with intangible property, and those acts would need to be amended first. Otherwise, once again, there would be an avalanche of litigation in respect of that, and it would mean that if there was a desire to, for example, be able to have certain rights to indigenous products, things such as rooibos coming to mind, or other traditional medicines, then of course those acts could be amended and a view could be taken towards that. The final point which I did touch on is that there needs to be a very careful consideration of other acts so that there is no conflict of laws, and that again that would create an environment for litigation which would be unnecessary and would delay the true objectives of this bill once it becomes an act. I will now hand over to my comrade Senzeni Mpila, who will present on a few further topics. Thank you.
Thanks, team.
Mr. Mpila, you have 1 minute.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Let me just move as quickly as possible in that 1 minute. As the Capital Capital Branch, we believe that this thing of expropriating authority should be amended in terms of it says current now, organ of the state of the or the way to person. Currently, the definition of expropriation means organ of the state or person empowered by the Act or any other legislation that acquire property through expropriation. Our understanding is that legally expropriation is an act of government. Therefore, it is understood in the correct, I mean, to correct it is at a expense to reason that it would be wrong to empower a person to perform a task of expropriation. Empowering a person to do so can lead to various wide range of legal disputes, abuse of power, even individual acting to advance corruption. So we strongly believe that the second issue that is very important is that we are proposing that you must have one single entity that is going to be able to deal with issues of expropriation. So the bill currently speaks about concurrency with other state institutions or state organs. We are saying that that particular, portion on the act, it must be removed. Therefore, there must be one single entity where any sphere of government or state institution wants to expropriate, they do apply. And then in that particular application, they can able to consider all the relevant issues that one is for public interest, two is for economic and social development, all those particular issues. And then we are saying that that particular authority must be given to the Minister of Public Works to appoint the agency. And then if our proposal comes through, then the portfolio committee's got the responsibility to expand the work and the responsibility of the agency in terms of the scope, define what type of the land that they can expropriate, report and accountable to the issues that are of course single entities. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Mtimpla. Thank you, the ANC branch from Western Cape. Honourable members, any questions for clarity? Any questions for clarity let's appreciate and the presentation done by this branch and also their introduction in explaining some of the questions and issues raised by some of the guests in this meeting. So we really appreciate that. Any other guests, Ms. Martinez?
The Gepi Shapiro branch was the last presentation that we had for the day. Thank you.
So that natural justice didn't come back?
No, they didn't, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. To all our guests today, those that presented their views on this important bill that seeks to repeal the Expropriation Act number 63 of 1975, we really appreciate that you took your time, that you have made some research, that you supported, that you opposed the bill with reasons, of course. So we are taking every single presentation that you have made, and we really appreciate that you participated in this meeting of today. From the agricultural sector to the valuers, which brought another dimension today, the business sector, the academics, the political parties who are representing ordinary people, we really appreciate your input. They will assist us in compiling a report, also in shaping how this bill should look like. As we crisscrossed the country, going to all the provinces, deep in the rural areas of Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Eastern Cape, KZN, listening to grandparents, old people, young people, when they discuss this bill, when they present their views on this important bill. And as such, as the committee, we captured all their presentation and all their notes, just as we did today, all your presentation. We will discuss, we will bring in the legal services of the parliament, but as you all know, each government of the day has to act in transforming the country, has to act in ensuring that the laws of previous government, and in this case, the apartheid government, they need to be transformed. But through that transformation, a responsible government like the one that we have today has to ensure that everyone is protected. We thank you again, our presenters, our guests, honorable members. We were supposed to start discussing this next week, but due to a change we will have time to discuss it. Platinise? Announcement? Ms. Martinez?
Thank you, Chair. Just one announcement, that as the Chair has alluded to the fact that the parliamentary program has changed, and that has necessitated a scheduling of a sitting of a plenary session tomorrow morning at 10, which coincides with the meeting that we had earlier scheduled to commence at 9 o'clock tomorrow, in which we were going to deal with petitions. That meeting has thus been cancelled until further notice. Other than that, Honourable Chairperson, we will be sending through an amended program based on guidance by the NAPC following that will be held in the following few weeks. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. We won't have the portfolio committee tomorrow, honorable members. We'll all be in the sitting that will start at 10. Thank you again, honorable members, for your time. And I know that you have been writing notes on the presentations, and we all have the presentations with us. We will read them and prepare for our meeting. Thank you again to our guests who took their time today to present their views on this important bill. Thank you to our support team that made all this possible. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.